Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Freeman. I serve as Lyndon LaRouche's national spokeswoman and his representative here in Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome all of you to this historic webcast, which takes place just 3 days before the first primary of the 2004 presidential campaign. As I think people know, Lyndon LaRouche has actually made the campaign for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States here in Washington, D.C., the cutting edge of our efforts nationally, because it is in fact the case that we believe that what happens here in Washington will set the tone for the subsequent primaries that take place. There are many people who are watching very closely the Washington, D.C. election, some with great pleasure and some with dread and alarm, because it is now quite clear that in the midst of this crisis, there is very little way to stop Lyndon LaRouche from positioning himself as a leader among the Democratic candidates. The fact of the matter is that the world right now is crumbling over the brink of a global financial breakdown crisis. Many of the conditions that we face are far worse than the conditions that we faced in 1928. This is compounded by the fact that since at least January of 2002, our government has pursued a policy of preemptive war. And that policy has not only caused major problems from the standpoint of U.S. budgetary matters, but as an illegal and unjust foreign policy, it has also successfully alienated a good portion of the nations of the world. Our foreign relations have deteriorated to an absolutely unprecedented point. And it is in the midst of this rapidly accelerating crisis on many fronts that this presidential election takes place. In the midst of all of these problems globally, the fact of the matter is that the United States itself is gripped by a monstrous crisis. We have unprecedented growth of the current accounts deficit. Our national debt is spiraling at an accelerating rate. 48 of the 50 states are officially bankrupt. And the fact of the matter is that the principle of the general welfare no longer guides U.S. policy. The dimensions of this crisis have led people of goodwill and economists of competence to do something that I think they would have preferred not to do, and that is to declare, essentially, that Lyndon LaRouche has been right. Last week, former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin did what one nationally known columnist described as joining the coalition of the shrill in describing the state of the U.S. economy. The fact of the matter is that it is just inescapable that what the United States needs is a new FDR. We need the kind of leader who will restore our Constitution's commitment to the general welfare and to put the forgotten man back at the center of national policy. There is only one Democratic candidate running who fits that description. There is only one Democratic candidate running who actually is qualified to be President of the United States. What I'd like to do before I introduce him today is I'd like to read to you an endorsement. There are many people around the United States who have endorsed Lyndon LaRouche. Some of them are more prominent nationally than this endorser. But I'd like to read this to you because I think it captures the nature of Mr. LaRouche's candidacy and Mr. LaRouche's personality, and also because it comes from someone who is well known and well loved here in the District of Columbia. The endorsement is from Dr. Abdul Alim Mohammed, who has served as the national spokesman to Louis Farrakhan, who led the fight to save DC General Hospital, and who is the director and founder of the Abundant Life Clinic, which remains the only full-service clinic in Anacostia. Dr. Alim wrote yesterday, "While it is always important to have a good president for the United States of America, there have been times when we've had one that wasn't all that good. But there have been other times in the past when the soundness of the individual who is the president has been absolutely crucial. The American Republic either would have not existed at all or would have been destroyed had it not been for the extraordinary leadership of Abraham Lincoln during the time of the war between the states, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt at the time of the Great Depression and the Great War against Fascism. In both those instances, the light of the American Revolution and its bright promise for humanity might have been extinguished by its traditional enemies, who are still its enemies at present. Today, even fools recognize that we have entered into a period of great global and national crisis, which threatens not only the survival of this nation, but even the concept of the sovereign nation state itself, and all of the constituent governing structures that serve the essential social, economic, political, and cultural needs of Americans and humanity in general, and that protect the inalienable rights of man. As Lincoln conceptualized that no nation could survive half free and half slave, so too today, the world cannot survive with a divided humanity, one part developed and seemingly prosperous, another underdeveloped and impoverished. The solution to this great problem for the nation is the same solution for the whole world. Only a man of great vision and morality, firmly rooted in the best civilized traditions of all mankind, is capable of formulating the kind of far-reaching and sufficient programs needed for the renewal of America and humanity as a whole. For these reasons, and others not mentioned here, I offer my endorsement for President of the United States of America to Democratic candidate Lyndon LaRouche, as the only candidate available to us who has the experience, the knowledge, and the moral courage to do what must be done from the office of president that will meet the challenge of this crucial moment in which the fate of all of human civilization as we have known it is to be determined. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. What I shall address today, before you get at me, which will come in due course, and also people out there through the media who will be calling in, as usual, including my wife, who will be watching very closely and supervising me implicitly from a distance for the moment. Three themes. First of all, the crisis in the formal sense, which the Democratic National Committee leadership is facing, and also the nine others. I wouldn't call them candidates, I'll call them the others. And secondly, the nature of the crisis, which is going to be a crisis for them, all of them, including the others. And then to get also a tougher point for the audience is what is wrong with the people of the United States and also the people of Europe, particularly Western Europe, that this that has happened to us could have happened. What must they do, not merely to change their preference in voting, but to change their way of thinking? Because despite the fact that most of our political leaders in Europe and in the United States have been incompetent over the past 40 years, have failed miserably, yet those are the people who were chosen to be leaders implicitly by the voters, either by voting or by not voting. So therefore, the American people in particular have to look inside themselves. It was their negligence which created the monster which I shall describe to you today. And unless the American people are willing to change the way they think, the United States is not going to survive. Make that clear. All right, now what we have is, to start with, we have the case of a gentleman who I'll come to in a moment, Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic national misleader, the official misleader. Now, McAuliffe typifies a problem of both himself, the Democratic national leadership at present, and the others. Common problem. First of all, Terry McAuliffe knows he's a liar. He sent out letters all over the place, messages all over the place, saying I'm an anti-Semite and a racist. He's a liar. The man is morally unfit to hold any public office in the United States. He's a public liar on an issue as important as the selection of the president. He is not fit to be seen in public. He should wear a mask from henceforth. Now, all of those others who have consented to go along with him also know that he's a liar. And yet their behavior toward me and toward my campaign is based on what they know to be a lie. They are unfit to be candidates for the President of the United States. We can't have a man who's soft on lying as a President of the United States, nor a candidate of the Democratic Party. They should resign in shame and purge themselves of this guilt, because none of them are morally fit to be President of the United States this time, particularly on the question of their behavior toward me. That is, they have adopted a lie as a basis for their behavior. The whole campaign, as run by the others, is one vast lie. They have said absolutely nothing of any substantive relevance to the issues that face the nation now. And they've talked at some length in many fora and over many media, and they have said less than nothing about the reality of the situation. So that's the creature. Now, there's a story which my wife likes very much. It's a story which is written out by one of the greatest poets and playwrights of human existence, Friedrich Schiller. It's a poem which has been referenced often by us at her instigation in organizational forms, Ibicus. Now, Ibicus was a real-life character of ancient Greece. He was a famous poet. He was not a great poet, but he was a famous and popular poet. And the story about him goes essentially as follows, as it's relevant to the case of the degenerating National Committee, as it's called today. He was on the way to participate in a conference at Corinth, where he was to be featured as a poet. And on the way, he was overtaken by two robbers who robbed him and murdered him. And dying of the wounds inflicted upon him, in his death agony, he looked up and there were two cranes flying overhead. And he cried out, "Let these two cranes be witness to the murder which is being done to me here." He died. And then events proceeded, including the two murderers who went to Corinth and sat in the crowd. In the course of this event, the Erinnyes, the monsters who take vengeance on the wrongdoers, sort of a spiritual force who suddenly appear as apparitions and destroy and tear apart those who've been the wrongdoers, appeared. And the appearance of these monsters was so frightening to the guilt-ridden criminals, the murderers, that they revealed their identity and were so judged because they exposed themselves for the murderers, the criminals they were. That is this. We have a picture of him, Terry McAuliffe. He sees them coming. They're coming to get him. He's about to confess. In any case, so the problem, what is going to happen is this in the election campaign. Right now, the important thing for me and for my campaign is to get as many votes as possible, as many delegates as possible, as much impact as possible, and to build a larger and larger movement centered on a youth movement. That's the mission orientation of the moment. Because we're marching toward a point of crisis which will settle accounts with the murderers, in a sense, the others, and Terry McAuliffe, and their crimes will be called to account rather soon. The date at which this will occur is not yet certain. But the arrival of that date is inevitable. Whatever happens in terms of scores and reports about progress of the election, during the interval until this moment arrives, is essentially irrelevant, except as we do our job. Except as I do my job, except as we build the movement, except as we win delegates wherever possible, get as much of the vote as possible, and mobilize especially among the forgotten men and women of the nation. Because those are the ones who can be called upon to make the change. That when they stand up on their hind legs and say, we're no longer going to be treated the way we're being treated, we're going to demand our rights, that's going to be the crucial thing that decides the future of this nation, as it did in the time that the Democratic National Committee of 1931 and 1932 did everything possible to prevent the winning candidate, Franklin Roosevelt, from winning, just as Beastman McAuliffe is trying to get me, stop me from winning. There's going to come a time soon in which all the good that we do in the meantime is going to come to a point of crisis for those who are committing the abuse. What is in process now, which is merely typified by the collapse of the value of the dollar relative to the euro. I guess the last I heard it was a euro was worth $1.28. Not so long ago, a euro was worth 83 to 84 cents. What this represents is a collapse of the US dollar. It's a collapse, relative now, by one-third. You measure it the other way, in terms of the 83 to 84 cents, it's a collapse by one-half since that time. If you look at the prices of groceries in the store over the past 6 months or so, you see a similar thing. The United States is going through a vast, accelerating rate of inflation. The inflation is being driven partly by the collapse of the value of the dollar. It's being driven by the fact that a great amount of money is being poured in to keep the Wall Street figures up, the official ones, the ones that don't look so good, they don't report. In other words, the figures that get into the averages, which are reported on the day's results of betting on the Wall Street lottery. Only the good cases are reported. The majority of cases that are moribund and are dying firms are not reported. They don't report unemployment. They only report employment. Well, the unemployment increases more rapidly than the gains of employment. And they call it a growth of employment. These are the things that are happening. Now, in the meantime, the current account deficit of the United States is piling up. The United States as a nation is bankrupt. Ah, but that's not the story. The world output is now estimated at $40+ trillion a year, of which the United States output has been reported in the range of $11 trillion a year. But the medium to short-term debt of the world is measured in hundreds of trillions of dollars. Now, how do you pay those figures off? You don't. You don't. So therefore, what happens at the point, the breaking point in the US dollar, means a general collapse of the system. This general collapse can come from any number of sources. It can come from a collapse of the mortgage-based securities bubble, the favorite bubble of bubbles, Alan Greenspan, the man who would never come clean, no matter how many years he sat in his bathtub. But he should try. He should get out of politics and get to his bathtub and hope that grace will strike him and get him clean again. So we're on the verge of something. And this something, whatever it is going to happen soon. It's going to happen this year. So soon, you're going to see a crisis hitting the United States and the world, much bigger than anything from the 1928-1933 interval. It's going to be an existential crisis, not a crisis of I'm poor or I've lost my job, an existential crisis. That's the time that the Irinis appear in the arena. That's the time that every delegate and every vote and every word of praise that one of the others has accrued becomes worthless currency, becomes trash. So therefore, you're in a period of crisis, a period in which it is in the short term ahead. This system is dead without any way of escaping in its own terms. So therefore, we're marching to create a force to deal with this crisis, which the Democratic National Committee leadership and the others pretend not to exist. Every word coming out of the mouths of these others is an exercise in futility. What are they talking about? They're talking about essentially nothing. One says, I am going to have a plan. Let me give you one of the worst ones. I heard it about 3 days ago. General screw-up, Wesley Clark. It was being interviewed. I don't know what the date of the interview was. It appeared on the television set about 3 days ago. 4 days ago, perhaps. No, yes. And he was asked how he stands on this and that. He said, well, he said, we got to get more money to the lower income brackets. Fine. Noble sentiment? Not at all. Hear the words that followed. You see, he argued, his argument was as follows, that people spend money. They have to have it to spend it. Now, the reason we've got to increase their income is because our economy needs people to spend more money. For the strength of our economy depends upon their ability to buy, not on their ability to consume what they need, but their ability to spend money to buy. That's the strength of our economy. I mean, the man is a blasted fool. No wonder they didn't give him that other star. They should have deducted about 3 or 4 on the basis of his performance in the Balkans. And then Kerry. Now, Kucinich does say a few things once in a while, which are right, but doesn't have much impact. Kerry, who is probably the only one of the others who has much substance to him as a candidate, has carefully concealed the substance as much as possible. I passed a piece of property in Boston just the other day on Beacon Hill, where he has a house which I understand has been mortgaged out for about $7 million. And he probably puts him in a lower income bracket up there. But in any case, he said nothing about anything of any importance. He said a little bit about this, a little bit about this. He refuses to get off the edge on the question of his being sucked in to support the Iraq war. He ducks the issue. He's now questions about it. He did say something once in the Congress about this thing. He knows that this was a fraud. He knows he was taken in. He is not man enough to say he was taken in, even though the evidence has been presented. This is the case with all of them. They double talk. They have a plan for this, a plan for that, a plan for this. All these plans mean nothing. The question is, where's the money going to come from? There is no source of money for this thing. Now, this is typical, and this is where I get to the hard part. It's typical of Americans, and not only Americans, but also Europeans. Very few people have much acquaintance with reality. Very few people know the difference between man and a monkey. That's why we vote for some of the candidates we vote for. Now, what does it mean? Some of you have been concentrating on this subject, some not, but concentrate. What's wrong? We, in the post-war period, came out under Roosevelt, and despite that fascist Truman, and I say that advisedly, I can prove it if contested, despite that, we still represented, into the middle of the 1960s, a producer society, which is the world's leading productive economy. Right? Then that changed about 40 years ago. It changed after the missile crisis. It changed after the assassination of Kennedy. It changed as we entered the Indochina War. People went crazy. The baby boomers went crazy. They were then in their late teens or entering university. They went crazy. They were frightened. They were frightened because they'd been raised by their parents of my generation, who'd become cowards when the right-wing turn came under Truman, who raised their children not to tell the truth, but to be careful about what they said, where they might be overheard by the FBI or something like that. So the young people, the parents of the baby boomers taught their children, the baby boomers, to lie. Don't get caught looking as if you might be FBI bait. The great right-wing turn, which later became known as McCarthyism. Right? So then when these children have been told never to quite tell the truth, because it might get their parents into trouble with the FBI, we're faced with a crisis. The crisis was no longer the charm. It was no longer Dr. Spock. And I don't mean that creep on the in outer space. I mean the one who was in the nursery back here on Earth. No longer this howdy-doody culture. Now things began to get nasty. Eisenhower, who had been their blessing and protector from the evil worms of Trumanism, and he did. He did a good job at that. But he brought in Arthur Burns, and that was bad. But then when he left and Kennedy was elected, Kennedy was not yet prepared, intellectually or otherwise, to deal with what was hitting him. Nor did he have the influence and understanding of the U.S. military, which he needed to have in that situation. And so, therefore, the funny people who Truman had brought into power, the fascists, the ones who nuclear war freaks, preventive nuclear war that Truman represented, these freaks came out of the woodwork, and they launched the Bay of Pigs. And they and their types internationally launched the 1962 missile crisis, where everyone was running into a bar calling for God. They were scared for several days. Then Kennedy was shot, and other things like that happened. They were terrified, and they said, I'm getting off this planet now. I've got a ticket. It's called LSD. So the world shifted with orchestration into a counterculture, the rock, drug, sex counterculture, which became the keystone for the culture as a whole of the baby boomers. Now, some people said, well, I never took LSD. Well, Matt, you couldn't find it? But they did, whether they took LSD, whether they had sex with five rabbits or not, to the degree they were gregarious, they learned to fit in with their generation, which for some people was called their degeneration. And therefore, they became responsive to what their neighbors thought. And the standard of culture within the entire generation, the standard of being accepted if you were applying for a promotion in a firm, you had to say the right things or you didn't get there. So even if you weren't an LSD freak, you had to be careful about the sensitivity of the LSD freak next to you. So the whole generation became, in the main, corrupted, running from reality into learning to go along, to get along. And this was as much true in Europe as in the United States. So we have a generation now in their 50s, ending their 60s, who culturally, as a generation, were sucked into going along to get along. If you want to survive, if you don't want your relative to send poison to you or something, go along to get along. Listen to what the press says, what the news media tells you, what the mass media tells you. These are the things. If you're not accepted by the mass media, nobody is going to accept you. Whether you like it or not, you have to learn to go along and get along and adapt to the mass media. That's the culture. So everybody is corrupt, or nearly everybody, in that generation. In Europe and in the United States, they are equally corrupt in that way. Because a society is not just a collection of individuals, it's a social process. If you don't resist the social process, which is corrupt, you become part of the corruption. If you are a typical citizen who looks like a typical citizen in everything you do, you are as corrupt as the rest because you went along with the operation. Just like these nine others who went along with what the DNC said. They didn't care if it was a lie. They went along with economic policies, which are a lie, to go along to get along. The motto hanging over the U.S. Congress is, go along to get along. The first thing they tell you when you go into the Congress, you're newly elected, you learn to go along to get along. When you go into a corporation for employment, go along to get along. When you're walking down the street, go along to get along. Who knows what else will happen to you? Be careful how you look. You're walking in that neighborhood. Go along to get along. Don't tell me you were individually different when you go along to get along. You're not different. You're just as corrupt as the guy walking down there, wandering through Never Never Land on LSD because you decided to go along to get along. Now what happens? It means that what you do, strictly for your own self-defense, you don't raise certain questions. You don't pose certain doubts. You don't resist certain things. Give an example. When I was 12 years old, I was exposed to a course, the high school course in mathematics. And in this period, I made a remark about geometry. And I was told this was silly, but I happened to be right. Because what they were teaching a geometry, which is so-called with its basic definitions, axioms, and postulates, which is based on arbitrary assumptions called a priori assumptions. And in this, they try to fit everything and explain everything that is deductively consistent with this geometry. And say that is reality. That's geometry. Now you have, particularly in the since the introduction of the new math, especially in every mathematics course, in all teaching about economics, about statistics, and so forth, the same nonsense is there. You're told that if you believe this, if you believe in these definitions, axioms, and postulates, you can prove something is true or not by using that kind of mathematics, if it's deductively consistent. But it's always wrong. The same thing has happened in society. You're told that free trade is good. You're told that this practice is good, that we're moving away from industry into post-industrial society. We're into the information age. You're told these things, and someone gives you a mathematical proof or statistics to prove that that's the way things are going. But it is that which has destroyed this country. Its economy. A submission to arbitrary doctrine, arbitrary definitions, axioms, and postulates of behavior. And I described this the other day in Germany at a cavalry school. The result is mentally, because the population accepts ideas like this elementary notion of geometry, definitions and axioms and postulates based on pure deduction, that the population becomes like a bunch of goldfish in a bowl. And the bowl is the axioms, definitions, and postulates. And the bowl is being carried to dump the fish in the toilet. But the fish swimming in the bowl decide that the future of their civilization depends upon staying in the bowl. That's what's happened to this society. We have accepted assumptions about economy, about behavior, about policy, which are assumptions like those made by a goldfish being carried to the toilet where he's about to be dumped. That's what the situation of humanity is. We assume that certain things work. They don't work. But time catches up with us. We reach the point that they cease to work, as they always will. Now, you look at this process in the history of mankind. We've referred to things like the Peloponnesian War. We've referred to other crises of that type, where societies have gone along for an extended period, multiple generations. And a once successful society adopts certain policies, and two or three generations later, it's collapsed, as ancient Greece. Ancient Greek society, which was a product largely of Egypt. In point of fact, it was the best features of it came in the shadows of the great pyramids of Egypt. And this is the birth of modern European civilization, or European civilization in general. And so this civilization rose as the most successful civilization of its time, from that time to the present. Modern European civilization. But then, with the Peloponnesian War, it destroyed itself. Then after that came a lower form of society than classical Greek culture, called Roman society, Italian society, which is inferior to Greek, morally and otherwise. And mankind did not recover from the effect of the degeneration that Roman imperial culture represented until the 15th century Renaissance, when for the first time, Europe returned to classical Greek culture and created the modern nation state. All during this period, the assumptions of law, the assumptions of behavior of all humanity up to the present, up until the 14th, 15th century, was that some people who are beasts treat the rest of the people as beasts. Beasts that rule by subjecting other beasts to the status of hunted or herded beasts. Most of humanity is treated most of the time like animals, like cattle, like human cattle. This is what we mean in the United States today when we talk about the lower 80% of family income brackets. In an earlier time, prior to the change, especially prior to the change that occurred from the middle of the 1960s on, we still believed in the notion that the development of the individual to their former potential as a thinking human being was a goal, even if it weren't reached in practice. That was the obligation to get to the point that all human beings were treated as truly human beings, not as cattle. That they developed around ideas, discoveries of principles. Science was an idea. Classical culture was an idea, because it represented the achievement of the recognition of the difference between man and the beast in the development of the individual. They stopped that. What has happened is that we are beasts ruled over by people who have become beasts. The people who run the society run it in a beastly way. Look at HMO, for example. 1973, the Nixon administration destroyed the Hill-Burton policy, which was the health care policy of the nation, and the security policy, the health security policy of the nation. What have we done? We've said, well, some lives are not worthy to be lived. Just like slaughtering the old cow. And we do that by pulling the plug in a hospital. We do that by denying care that would keep people alive, because we say their lives are not really that worth living. They've had their run. It's time for them to go. Look, they're too sick. They're suffering. We should relieve their suffering. Let them go. Deprive them of care. They're not worth it anymore. It's not economically sound. Don't educate people above their class. For example, go back to the history of the United States in terms of the post-Civil War period, in Reconstruction. Prior to the end of the Civil War, the leading edge of U.S. policy against slavery was that the first step toward freedom was to elevate the mind, the policy of Frederick Douglass, whose homestead is not far from here. That a person who is free in their mind, who knows the culture of the human race, who knows the best in music, the best in that, that this person is free in their own mind. And people who are free in their own mind, in that sense, can be made free as people. The first step to freedom is knowledge, the power of knowledge, and the knowing what the difference is between a human being and a beast. We took that away. We took it away right after, even under the period of Reconstruction. We said of the slaves, are we going to educate these slaves in schools with our knowledge? No. We are not going to make them dissatisfied by educating to the point that they will be dissatisfied with lives of menial labor. Therefore, we will create an educational system which will keep them in their place. We will tell them it's their culture that is good for them. Telling a person that it's good to be a cow, to be milked as a cow. The same thing happened in health policy under the HMO system. We no longer have a health policy based on the assumption that a human being is a human being and that life is sacred and important. We now say, well, the private corporations that invest yesterday in taking over a health plan have a right to their share of profit. And if they're not getting enough profit, then they're going to have to cut down on the care given to the patients, the recipients, which is what they do. Look at the increase in the cost of health care under all kinds of plans now. Look at the cuts in health care. Look at the number of hospitals that are closed. Look at all these things that we go through here. Human beings are being treated as human cattle, and they're told that that's the best they can get if they're in the lower 80% of family income brackets. They vote that way. Citizens don't vote for what's good for the nation, they vote for a little thing they think they can get. They say, well, this candidate's going to give us this, and we think we ought to unite and get it. They don't say what's good for the country. They say, well, maybe this guy will give us this. So they sell themselves, they sell their birthright for a piece of pottage, and turn themselves thus into virtual slaves again. This is what has happened to us, this kind of thing. We have people who think of themselves as people in power, and we think of ourselves as people who are under the thumb of those with power. We think of ourselves as predatory animals who are the guys on top and the victims, the animals on the bottom. And we begin to think like animals. We begin to react like animals. And out of that, you get some fascists and things like that. So what's happened is this, is when you discuss issues in campaigns, what do you get? Look at what the others are doing. Are they talking about the great crisis, the worst crisis in modern history coming down now? Are they talking about the changes in policy needed, the changes in axioms and definitions and postulates needed to get this nation through the crisis? No. They're talking about a plan within the framework of existing policies and doctrines to make a slight adjustment in the coefficients. A little more for this bracket of income, a little less for this one. You'll have to sacrifice for this. Fiscal austerity. Now, let's look at the economics of this, just to make this clear. There is a Washington Post, and if there's one thing that's worse than the Democratic National Committee in Washington, D.C., it's the Washington Post. Their capacity for telling the truth is at a minimum. Today, they demonstrate how bad they are by an attack on the president of all people. You would think he's bad enough that they would approve him. But they attacked him. They attacked him on his proposal to do something about space exploration. Now, the argument, of course, is the following. Let's look at the history of the space program. This gives you a typical idea of what the Post thinks they can sell, demonstrates what they think the state of mind of the population of their readers is. And what the state of mind of their readers, if it's what the Post estimates, is very, very low. I'll explain to you. All right, what about the space program? What about Bush says we're going to have a space program? Well, Bush, in his own stumbling way, has done one thing right. It must come as a sweet relief to all of us that this president, so ill-chosen, could do one thing right. Maybe he might even be able to do two things right, like walking the dog or something, huh? What's the point? We had a space program which was announced by President Kennedy, who was not exactly a dummy. Now, what did this space program do? This space program unleashed a technological revolution in the United States such that for every penny we spent on the space program, we got at least a dime back in terms of benefits. Benefits which were produced by scientific discoveries and technological progress generated within the space program, which then spilled over into other parts of the economy to increase the quality of life and the productive power of our people. So the space program was not money thrown into outer space. The space program was money invested in increasing the productive powers of the American people by a factor of up to 10 for every bit spent on it. The same thing would be true now. Now, here's where Bush, of course, fails. I've been at the space program, I've been attacked, promoting it, and I've been attacked for it over a long period of time. What's the point of the space program? We go into outer space because we're in search of something called power. We on Earth are searching for power on Earth through space exploration. Why? This comes to the hard part I promised you. In ancient Greece and before ancient Greece, a concept existed called spherics. Now, spherics is rather elementary. If you don't have any definitions, axioms, and postulates, or other such trash hanging around, and you look up to try to understand what's going on in the nighttime sky, or by special methods looking at the nighttime sky in daylight, then you realize that you're looking out, and you're seeing these objects, these illuminated objects in space, stars and planets, and there's a process of motion going on in the whole system, and there's motion within the system of motion. Now, you don't know how far these objects are away from Earth. You just know the angular distance between them as you observe them, and the changes in angular distance. This was called spherics. This, and all mathematics and all mathematical physics of the early Greeks was based on the Egyptian conception of spherics, which you can find expressed in the pyramids of Giza, about 2700 BC. The pyramids contain exhibitions of elementary principles of spherics. This was the work of Thales of Ionia. This was the work of the Pythagoreans. This was the basis for the mathematics of people such as Plato. So therefore, looking up, you find these anomalies. And you come up with a definition when you discover certain physical principles by making these kinds of observations. First of all, you say, how is the universe run? Universe. We are here in a universe. How is this universe run from the standpoint of spherics? There's certain principles we call universal physical principles. From that beginning in ancient Egypt and Greece, through the Platonic process of the pathway charted by Plato, we came to an understanding, a more general understanding, of universal physical principles, including microphysics, nuclear physics, and below. So we discover these universal physical principles. What are we looking for? We're always going back to this standpoint of spherics, of looking at the universe in which we're located and trying to discover what principles are universal in all parts of the universe. How do we do that? We do that by astronomy. We do that the way Kepler discovered the principle of gravity, uniquely. We do it by taking the same approach to microphysics. We find a relationship between the microphysical and the astrophysical. These kinds of things. Universal physical principles. What happens in space exploration? We are looking out to the universe to do what? To discover new physical principles, universal physical principles, which once discovered will be applicable to our life on Earth. And that's exactly what the space program, the Kennedy space program, demonstrated. If you look out at the challenge of exploring space, you're forcing yourself to see problems and opportunities which show you principles you otherwise would not discover. Now let's take where Bush missed the point. Well, the space program now misses the point. Mars moon exploration. Von Braun earlier, back in the 1950s, said that if we're going to send someone to Mars in the future, we would never send one ship. And he used in his example the fact that Columbus had three ships when he crossed the Atlantic. Why? Because you're going into the unknown. And you could never build into an exploration of the unknown a pre-certainty of what you're going to find. Therefore, when you go into the unknown, you are going into the area of the unexpected. And what is going to happen, if it's important, is going to be unexpected. You're not going to prove something you already know. You're going to find something you didn't know. And you're going to run into an encounter with it. And your life may depend upon your ability to deal with that encounter. So you don't send one lonely ship out there. You don't take a model of the shuttle and take a model of the shuttle and send it on a trip to Mars. That would be idiocy. You wouldn't even send a shuttle-type model to the moon regularly. We did it once. We did it to demonstrate a point. But there was a large risk involved. Going to Mars is tremendous risk. Now, traveling that distance as a human being over the months it would take over a gravity inertial flight or a low-powered flight is also a high risk. You're going out and subjecting human bodies into conditions which are unknown. You don't know what the effects of this kind of environment is on the human body. You're taking a very long trip if you're using an inertial flight or a low-power flight. When you get there, you don't know what you're going to be running into for human beings. Therefore, what you do is you have to carry a logistical capability for adapting to problems. First, beforehand, we need a more powerful form of flight. We need a higher order of power. We need at least nuclear propulsion. You would never send anybody to Mars as a human being with any less capable system than nuclear propulsion. What is recommended is thermonuclear fusion propulsion, which has already been worked on, that problem. Because if you had a 1G rate of acceleration by propulsion, guess how long it would take you to get to Mars? You go up to midpoint at a certain speed, and you decelerate down into Mars. How about a weekend flight? Or how about a few days flight or a week flight? So therefore, what you require then is a logistical system extending from Earth by way of the moon into space to make these kinds of explorations into the unknown, into the unexpected. What's the result? What do we discover? We discover new things about the solar system we didn't know, and these things will reflect our understanding of what is going on the planet Earth itself. This will give us new technologies, for example, for developing the Sahara Desert, for managing this planet. So this is not some kind of a joyride. It is not a weekend excursion to entertainment park. This is very serious business. And it's from this sort of thing that we get the scientific technology which enables man to increase the productive power of mankind on this planet, to find better ways of managing relatively scarce natural resources and things of that sort. So what Kennedy had in mind, or what he proposed, was not some joyride into space. What he proposed was a thrust into the unknown, which would open up to us new knowledge of what goes on in the universe, including what goes on Earth itself, and what we can do on Earth. So just as in the first phase of the Kennedy space program, crash program, so now a space program would function as a science driver to give us the new technologies, the new principles to increase the productive powers of man on Earth. Look at what we have in China, for example. You have a country of over 1.3 billion people. It's crowded largely into a coastal region, and they're very poor people, for the most part. Some are fairly rich, but most are very, very poor. The inland regions are poorly developed. Therefore, to do it for the future of a Chinese population, which is growing, you need to build vast infrastructural systems in China. Water systems of the type that are being developed. Power systems, especially nuclear power, absolutely indispensable. Large-scale mass transit systems, like rail systems and magnetic levitations. New urban centers. The transformation of land, of relatively arid, poor land, into richer land by these kinds of processes. These things are all necessary for humanity. But we have limited resources on this planet. To the north of China, Central Asia and North Asia, you have vast resources under desert and under tundra. But these minerals themselves, which were deposited largely by living processes billions of years ago, a chalk cliff, how many trillion dead bodies of animals are in a chalk cliff? We find minerals. You find them how? They're deposited by the bodies of animals or plants in the earth, in the fossil areas of the earth. We go down there, we dig them out. How do we replace them if we use them up? These are the kinds of questions that have to be faced if we're looking at two or three generations ahead. We're trying to give an orientation to the meaning of life. If we care not about just going along to get along in our generation, but if we think about the future of humanity. These are also morally important because we're all going to die. But what assures us of immortality? Certainly not Tom DeLay. Certainly not John Ashcroft. What assures us of a sense of immortality is a demonstration that we as human beings do have in practice an immortality, which we express by scientific and other progress. When we transmit cultural knowledge and so forth, and scientific knowledge, from the work of our generation into future generations, we are expressing the immortality of human beings, an immortality which does not exist in animals, the immortality of those ideas which represent these discoveries. So when you look back today to an Archimedes or an Aristophanes or other great names known to us in science, we are reliving what went on in their minds to make these original discoveries on which we continue to depend today. We see that kind of connection of ourselves to those who went before us. And we wish that we would be that kind of people who had a similar relationship to those who come after us. The idea that our dying is not for nothing, that our dying is a point at which we cease to be living people, but what we have represented lives on after us as a benefit and improvement for coming generations. That is our sense of immortality as in our practice in life. When we go into space, to explore space, to make discoveries which will improve the condition of life of future generations of humanity, we know that our coming and going between birth and death is not a mere existentialist exercise of being thrown on a mud heap. That life means something. That life is a mission. And for people to sense themselves as human and to treat others among them as human, they must have some sense of mission in life. You must have a mission in life, a purpose for living, something that is counterposed to the rate of adolescent and older generation suicides, which is increasing in the world today. What will save this planet? What gives you the courage to face whatever you have to face for humanity is a sense of mission, that your life is a penny and that you're spending it wisely, and that expenditure of your penny means something which honors your ancestors and as a benefit to those who come after you. This sense is lost in the population today. It's lost especially with the baby boomer generation. And you have this conflict between the youth generation, the young people, the 18 to 25 group, and their parents' generation. The parents' generation have no sense of immortality. They seek it in places like Tom DeLay's barroom, or whatever else he has there from places, the barroom he used to attend. They don't seek it within the meaning and practice of their own lives. They don't see society as having a mission. They think, well, what they're getting out of life. They're like Hamlets, who was willing to go out and die and be killed, but he had lacked the courage to save his nation because he had no faith in there being a meaning for his having lived after he's dead. And that's the typical problem of politicians today. What you're looking at, this group of others, at their very best, they are Hamlets. They are futile existence with no sense of the future, with no mission, no purpose. And because they have no sense of mission themselves, when a nation like our own needs a mission, it is not from them you'll get one. My job is to give the people of the United States, in particular, a sense of mission, our mission as a nation in the world, what we have to do among nations to lead other nations by leadership, not by rule, not by domination, not by giving orders, but by being a factor of leadership on this planet, which gets this planet out of this horrible danger before us now. And those who don't have that shouldn't be president. Roosevelt had something of that. Lincoln certainly did. Franklin certainly did. All of our best national leaders had a sense of mission, of their life as a penny spent for the advantage of coming humanity and for honor of previous generations. That is lacking in our politics today. And my job, above all else, above what I must do as president, my job is to bring that sense of mission and that sense of immortality of each individual back into our politics again. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. You can tell how old he is. Most people here don't even know what a penny is anymore. Let me just give people some idea of the format that we will follow. There are audiences gathered around the United States, and in fact around the world, who are listening to this webcast. They are submitting questions via email. I will entertain those questions as they come in. People here in the audience will also have the opportunity to ask questions. I also would just like to remind people who are gathered here and people who are listening via the internet that we will be airing a 30-minute spot tomorrow here in Washington, D.C. This is the half-hour TV program that we've prepared, which is entitled The Next President. It did show here on Wednesday. It will show again tomorrow, Sunday, January 11th, on WRC here in Washington, which is Channel 4. And that will be at 12:30 in the afternoon. Tonight, for those of you who are located in New Hampshire, Mr. LaRouche will be on WMUR-TV out of Manchester at 7:30. And I would encourage you to watch those shows. What I'd like to do is I'd like to go to some of the questions that have been submitted via the internet and also to entertain a couple of questions that came in from some institutional representatives. We have one question that came in actually from a sitting member of Congress. He said, Mr. LaRouche, there's been very heavy criticism of the U.S. Congress for not standing up to Bush when he has pursued various bad policies. But during the last session, Congress enacted what was much needed legislation to ensure that some 18 million lower income workers in the United States would be entitled to overtime pay. Last week, the Department of Labor, I assume under the instruction of the President, put out guidelines instructing employers how to legally avoid paying those 18 million workers that overtime. My question to you is, what do you do in a situation like that if you're a member of Congress?
This is where the party system breaks down. The function of a political party, particularly the members of the party in the Congress, is to deal precisely with an issue like this. This is a legitimate campaign issue as opposed to the garbage you've been getting from some of these others in the campaign so far. This is a scandal. It's a scandal. It's a fraud. It's an obvious attempt to defeat a law which has been enacted by Congress, a resolution, and it's an immoral decision that was made to try to defeat that. They're trying to cheat people at a time that people are getting poorer and cheating poorer people. They could spend $87 billion on a fund for Iraq to bail out Halliburton and Bechtel, and you can't spend for people. The other side of the thing is that the whole character of this kind of legislation and this kind of behavior of the administration is totally immoral and incompetent. You do not use, for everyone should know, you don't use Schwarzenegger methods. You don't terminate the population to deal with a crisis. What you do is the opposite of fiscal austerity. Under depression, the way to deal with the depression is to put people to work. By putting people to useful work, you increase the total product. You increase the income of a state, of the nation. You increase the income and the product. You're increasing the national output, and you're increasing the national income. You're increasing the national tax revenue base. So cuts, particularly cuts in productive employment, are the worst thing you can do. Now, the overtime thing is typical of this. We're laying people off, and now people are demanding that those who remain employed increase their hours of work. In the case of Walmart, you don't get paid for the extra hours you work at all. And if you need the job, you stay and you eat it. Eat the loss. It's real slavery. The problem is, here's the failure of the Democratic Party in particular. The Democratic Party is supposed to be the champion of the people. It's supposed to deal with the forgotten man and woman. Is supposed to help take care of those who cannot take care of themselves. To represent them, this is a citizen. A citizen has rights. We are here to protect the rights of the citizen when the citizen as an individual can't do it, or a small group. We are to give justice to the people. And when these fools, these others, get up there and babble about their plans that don't mean anything, and don't take on the issues of that type, the so-called bread and butter issues, which are routine. You create a clamor. A real party would create a clamor. Bush would stop that in the morning. You build up several issues like that. Bush would lose the election in advance. You build up a number of scandals about what they're doing to people and make it clear he's lost right then and there. But this bunch of guys are going to throw the election to him, given a chance, a re-election to him, and he won't even know he's president. So that's the problem in this thing. When the party system fails as a party to take this on, then the individual member of the legislature realizes that he needs or she needs a party Because as an individual, he does not have the clout, unless he's a very exceptional person, to have that kind of influence. But a significant number of members of the Congress united can change the situation in a case like this. The problem is the Democratic National Committee doesn't want it to happen. This happened with Schwarzenegger in California. The reason the Democratic Party lost the state of California to a beast man, to a Schwarzenegger, a son of a Hitler lover, who doesn't seem to lack any of those parental qualities himself, because the Democratic National Committee put the lid on the Democratic Party's fight against Schwarzenegger. And Lieberman led the charge, one of the candidates. And that's why the Democratic Party lost California. And that's why people in California are going to suffer now, because the Democratic Party told the governor not to fight seriously. If he'd fought seriously, we would have won, as we proved with the youth movement in Los Angeles County, and we proved in the Bay Area, that what we were doing as a youth movement there could win and would win. But in the rest of the state, we lost, because the ever-loving Democratic Party and a strain of candidates, including Wesley No Good Clark, came out there to put the lid on the issue. So therefore, the importance of having a fighting party which will deal with these things when there is no other forum to deal with them is the difference. And that's what we've got to create. We've got to get rid of this DNC crowd now. We've got to shake the thing up. And I think nothing is going to work until we do shake them up, or until the Irindians come and scare the pants off them.
Okay, the next question comes from somebody who actually sat on the Council of Economic Advisors during the first Clinton administration. He says, Mr. LaRouche, on questions of economics and global finance, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that sometimes you are criticized as being an alarmist. But last week, I was very surprised to hear a speech by Robert Rubin in which he clearly echoed what you've been saying. One of the points that Robert Rubin made is that the current policy of driving down the dollar and of supporting the low dollar, which is clearly the policy of this administration, would be incompetent and a bad policy under any circumstances. But he said that in a dollarized world, it is catastrophic. I don't think that people understand exactly what he meant, and I think it would be useful if you would please explain.
In a certain way, certain sense, what the statement is true, that the administration is driving down the dollar. But it's driving down the dollar by existing. And then after discovering that it's driving down the dollar, it comes up with an explanation and gives us an excuse, saying it's a good thing to drive down the dollar. It's like a fellow, you know, driving a car down the street, and he hasn't repaired it very well, and one wheel after the other is falling off the automobile. He says, look, that's the way to drive an automobile. The car was coming apart, and now he tried to make a virtue out of it. It's better to have without wheels, it's cheaper. The point here is that people believe in money. And money has no intrinsic value. Money is a promissory note by somebody, sometimes a government, which is worth something if the government's some any good and controls its money. Value does not lie in money. Value lies in physical production, physical effects, such as food, clothing, shelter, basic economic infrastructure, mass transit, technologies that improve the productive powers of mankind, the education that enlivens the productive powers of the individual mind of the student, and so forth. Cultural activities which give people the insight into the forms of cooperation which increase man's welfare in society. These are economic values. When you start to measure things in money terms, it's fraud. Just the thing that has to be pointed out on this, and I'm sure the questioner would understand this. Look, We take one set of figures. What is the magnitude, or the estimable magnitude, of the outstanding short-term claims in financial derivatives sitting on top, in terms of hundreds of trillions of dollars, sitting on top of a world which has a little more than $40 trillion of annual output? What is the value of a dollar in which the current account deficit is over $1 trillion, where the national debt is soaring to $1 trillion, where the amount of debt in the system is beyond the actual value of the whole system? So the point is that what is wrong is that 40 years of policy has been wrong, especially since the 1971-72 period. We are now at a point that there is no solution except to put the whole international monetary system through financial bankruptcy reorganization. We must now put every central banking system and the Federal Reserve System of the world into bankruptcy, into receivership for bankruptcy reorganization. The government of the United States, as part of this, must put the Federal Reserve System into receivership for bankruptcy or reorganization. The receivership operation will wipe out much of the paper, but the receivership will actually function as a national bank in Alexander Hamilton's sense of national banking. We will then freeze what we have to freeze. We will assure that essential production and services continue, that pensions are paid, that banks keep their doors open, and things of that sort. And we will launch a growth on a large scale. We're talking about tens of millions of people being put back to work. It means large-scale infrastructure. It means large projects, power projects, power distribution and production. It means water management projects. It means mass transit projects. It means rebuilding our school system. It means rebuilding our healthcare system. We put people back to work and useful work and increase the amount of wealth, and we can manage our way through. It will take us a quarter of a century to work our way out of this bankruptcy, but we will be working our way out successfully. So therefore, all these discussions break down precisely at that point. When you consider the magnitude of what's out there, let's take, for example, the case of Parmalat. Now, Parmalat is not an Italian problem, as I think the questioner understands. Parmalat is an example of the way an international parasite, including leading U.S. banking institutions, have groped around the world like super Schwarzeneggers, groping here, groping there, groping here, groping there, to try to find operations from which they could steal or which they could leverage a process of theft, Enron style or worse. Now, some new form which different than what happened in 1998 has emerged. This form reached out to entities like Parmalat, said, hey, here's a nice juicy thing. This process is food. It's a highly successful, most successful food processor in Europe. Let's move in on it. Let's show them how to make more money by going into the market, into the financial market. So who stole the money? Parmalat? No. It was not Parmalat that stole the money. It was their bankers, including certain well-known U.S. bankers, largely through operations run through, not Italy, but the Cayman Islands. Paradise, the Cayman Islands. And so therefore the problem lies in not facing the fact that the dominant U.S. bankers, or a large part of them, are the thieves who caused the problem, who are depreciating the dollar. The dollar has been sucking on the rest of the world. Japan has reached the limit on bailing out the dollar. Europe is not going to bail out the dollar anymore. So therefore, the dollar is bankrupt. It has no adequate flow of funds from outside the United States to continue to pump up the Wall Street bubble. Therefore, the whole thing has reached the point, the asymptotic point, in which the whole thing is coming down. And all discussion is unclear until you raise this issue. And what people don't understand, the reason they don't understand the gobbledygook, is because people don't take them to the real issue. And so, very simply, look, here's the debt out there. Here's the world's debt, short-term debt. Hundreds of trillions against a world whose annual output is estimated at $40-odd trillion. Now, how are you going to manage that debt? You can't. The world is bankrupt. It's financially bankrupt. And you're going to have to wipe out most of that debt through a financial reorganization, through receivership in bankruptcy conducted by governments, a concert of governments. There is no other solution. Once you say that, then people will be able to understand what we're talking about this dollar depreciation. But unless you're willing to explain to people that we have to bankrupt the system in order to save the economy, until you tell them that, they don't understand what you're talking about. That's the problem.
Lynn, this is from the chairman of the history department at one of the local community colleges. He says, Mr. LaRouche, Robert Sinnott's book, Days of Deceit, documents that FDR knew in advance about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And he did nothing about it because he believed that the U.S. population could not have been mobilized to fight the war otherwise. While there's an argument that could be made for this, it also resulted in many American servicemen dying. Do you think that this explanation is true? And if it is true, do you think that his actions were justified?
No, it's not true. The people who circulated this were probably, in terms of the publishing apparatus, committing a knowing fraud. The Japan attack on Pearl Harbor, the intended attack on Pearl Harbor, was known during the period of the early 1920s naval power parity negotiations. During that period, when the United States was resisting submitting to an arrangement under which the British Navy would be the dominant force on the world's oceans, the British and Japan, which had become, in 1890s, had become a puppet, Japanese prime minister, a Japanese emperor, had become a puppet of British interests. At that point, the British and Japanese were committed to building a naval force to destroy the U.S. naval power. The assignment of Japan from that time on was to build a naval force for an attack upon Pearl Harbor. This issue came up again during the later part of the 1920s with the Billy Mitchell case. Now, on the basis of knowing that the Japan plan of attack for the Japan's partnership with Britain for a war against the United States, remember, the British monarchy and the Japan monarchy were prepared and committed to, as an option, to conduct war against the United States in the 1920s. In this context, an army officer, General Billy Mitchell, said, we can take a large ship, and we can actually put bombers and base bombers on a ship. And this ship can then drop bombs which can sink major naval vessels, cruisers and battleships. And that is our defense of Pearl Harbor against a Japan attack. He was court-martialed for this at the instigation of a number of members of the Navy Department and people behind them who were pro-British, including some bankers in New York who were pro-British. That was that at that point. So already, U.S. intelligence fully knew and was planning for a defense against a joint attack by British and Japan naval forces upon the United States, 1920s. This came up again in a big way in June 1940. The British Expeditionary Forces and the French were defeated by Germany in 1940, June of 1940. British Expeditionary Force and other troops were on the beaches at Dunkirk. Hitler was holding back the tanks, which could have overrun the forces at that time. Why? Because he thought that Lord Halifax and others in Britain were going to join Hitler with Franco, with Mussolini's Italy, and with others in an alliance to, number one, quickly destroy the Soviet Union, and then move on to consolidate the naval forces of Japan, Germany, Britain, Italy, and France against the United States. Now, at this point, Churchill and some of the bankers of New York who had put Hitler into power in Germany decided they were not going to go along with the deal. They decided they did not want to have a German dictator running their fascist universe. That was Churchill's motive, the British Empire. Save the British Empire, not make it a junior partner of the Nazi system. So at that point, Hitler's plan of world conquest was neutralized because Britain and the United States were able to block it with the aid of Admiral Canaris, who terrorized Franco into not overrunning Gibraltar. And when Gibraltar was not overrun by the Spanish on behalf of Hitler, then it was impossible to block off the Mediterranean, which was the plan of that time. So at that point, everything shifted. And the doom of Nazi Germany was inevitable, more or less, at that point. But it was war to be fought yet. So at that point, we had problems inside the United States, which came from Wall Street, the Wall Street bankers, who were influential forces who wanted the United States to be attacked, or had been up to that point, was still in that inclination. So what we did in order to deal with this attack, in part, was we took our fleet carriers for a Billy Mitchell-style operation against the Japanese Navy, the Battle of Midway. At that point, Japan was on the way to defeat. So what was happened is that the carrier fleet was pulled out away from Hawaii and pulled into the Pacific to intercept the major attack from Japan, which was essentially defeated at the Battle of Midway. So that's the nature of the situation, that Roosevelt, under those circumstances, did not have this secret advanced knowledge of Japan's attack. Japan's attack was known. What was not known, what Roosevelt did not know, as I found out from Japanese later on, some decade or so ago, is what had happened is the Japanese at the last minute decided to stack on their aircraft carriers to put a large military land-based naval aircraft fleet additionally on the carriers so that the aircraft forces of Japan, which attacked Pearl Harbor, were far larger than U.S. estimates had expected. And that was the intensity, the ferocity of the attack on Pearl Harbor was caused by this change in the Japan plan for deployment over the original plan. That's the nature of the situation. But what has happened is since that time, we have from the Cato Institute and others, an active effort in the United States by the right wing to try to do everything possible to discredit FDR. And therefore, this story has been circulated. Whereas the true story of the general circumstances, which are all documented, well known, were already known. And these reports that I've seen, like this book business, what I've seen, ignore and does not mention the essential features of this thing. And by fallacy of composition, we know that the story is a hoax, and an intentional hoax.
Those of you who are listening via the internet, you're listening to a live address from Washington, D.C. by Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche. For those of you in the audience who have questions for Mr. LaRouche, what I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to ask you to just put your name and your affiliation, if any, on an index card, and people on the staff here will collect them and bring them up. I will call your name and call you up to the microphone. If you want me to ask the question for you, write it out, but you don't have to. All I really need is your name, because in just a minute I will begin entertaining questions from the audience here, and we'll go back and forth. The next question comes from someone in Alabama who is a fairly well-known former civil rights leader in that area. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I was just a boy in Birmingham, Alabama, when I got involved in Dr. King's movement. I did it because I wanted to be part of what he was doing, and I did it against my parents' wishes at the time. And I can tell you I was scared. I was so scared that I can still remember the taste of that fear when we were loaded into the wagons to be carted off to Governor George Wallace's jails. On the way, I have a very distinct memory of one of the older boys, who I believe had been trained by SNCC, who started to sing. He had a good voice, but not a remarkable voice. But before long, we were all singing too. And we kept singing the whole time we were there. The more we sang, the more we annoyed the guys who were running the prison. And that was certainly good. But it's also the case that the more we sang, the less scared I felt. And to this day, I don't really know why that was. But one of your organizers told me that your youth movement in Washington, D.C. has been marching through the ghetto singing. Is it to alleviate people's fear because of the crisis, or is there something more involved? I'd really be interested to hear what you say about this, and I hope to see you in Alabama soon.
Now, it's the positive thing that's important. It does have this ameliorative effect, but it's the positive thing as much, which is why I've emphasized this business, you know, in our organization all along. I've been hammering people on the issue of the bel canto, the Florentine bel canto model of the human singing voice, and of classical composition. For example, let's take one background in general history. Let's take something like Sanskrit and the Vedic before it. Now we have, as was emphasized by Gal Tilak in his Orion and later Arctic Horn, is that Vedic transcripts, Vedic poems, which by internal evidence refer to astronomical sightings, positions, dating from between 400 and 600 BC, show a certain level of culture at that time and so forth, but they also show something else. During this period, this interval, which is approximately 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, during this interval, the greater part of it, the transmission of these poems, which contain this astronomical data, so to speak, were transmitted by word of mouth by chanters. Chanters who to this day, as Sanskrit chanters, often do not know the language they're singing in. But nonetheless, as a study at Pune was done by the experts there, which showed that the degree of variation from a disagreement among the chanters is minimal. that the chanting form, the poetic form, preserves the intention as the loose spoken word does not, or written word does not. Thus it shows that the quality of musicality, which is biologically built into the design of the human being, is a device by which we are able to maintain memory and to reconstruct memory. And therefore, the singing of certain types, which conforms to these principles, becomes a way of sharing the communication of ideas among people and affects a sense of unity among people who participate in it, which is not otherwise achievable. This is demonstrated by, you know, good choral training and bel canto voice training. So these qualities, which are shown by more and more sophisticated type of song, that these qualities are actually bring forth or bring to the surface effective use of powers of the mind which are otherwise lacking. Give an example. You often see on television, for example, or radio, announcers who speak, and they speak like ticker tape. And you find it extremely difficult to find out what the meaning is of what they were saying, if there is any meaning indeed there. You find that actually cultivated speech is a reflection of the same principles as singing, as classical singing. That the mind responds to this. If you cannot actually express irony or metaphor effectively in ticker tape speech. You cannot do just run-on words. You cannot level out. You have to have musicality. You have to have articulation. You have to pause. All these kinds of characteristics which are in poetry. You must have them. And so, therefore, when people are sharing, people are disunited, a bunch of people, on the streets, common purpose but disunited, how do you have them come to the point that they're able to speak as if with one voice, with one purpose, to have not only to express that outwardly, but to know they're expressing a common intention outwardly to an audience, but also to themselves. So therefore, you bring about a sense of unity, coherence, and mission orientation, which is otherwise lacking. You take an amorphous mass of people, and suddenly they become a force. And when you sense you are a force, you feel much more powerful. I can tell you, I guarantee our youth will tell you that about Washington, D.C. too, that the singing gives you a sense of yourself as a force. And it creates a sense of response in the people you're singing to, who sense that you are representing a force. And they want to be part of that force. They want to participate in that force. And therefore, this is a positive feature, essentially, even though it does tend to ameliorate negative effects. It is not primarily negative. It's not a fear reaction. It's saying, in an emergency, make yourself a force.
Okay, I need a couple of minutes to sort through some of the stuff we're getting in from the internet. So the next question is going to come from the audience. It's from one of the leaders of the LaRouche Youth Movement who has been organizing here in D.C. I'm going to ask him to come up to the microphone. Nick, where are you?
Hello, Mr. LaRouche. My question is dealing with the organizing, and I actually have two questions, but I guess the one I'll say is when we're out on the street organizing, when I'm out on the street, we have a number of things we have to do. Meet people, get phone numbers, make contacts, but also distribute a lot of literature, make sure people have our literature out there. And we're also And I guess the most fundamental thing is trying to take the time to actually change the people we're talking to out on the street. And my question is, I find that when I'm talking to, one of the biggest problems I have is when I'm talking to people of a really entrenched fundamentalist nature out on the street. And that can be often of a religious fundamentalism, maybe Christian fundamentalism, where the mind is completely shut down and it almost seems impossible to get them to recognize when a paradox exists. They almost seem to have an ability to just, you know, say, well, this doesn't matter because the Bible says this, and then get past the paradox, which makes it very difficult to have a Socratic dialogue. How do you know when to just say, okay, I've done as much as I can with this person in the time I have now. There are a lot of people out there I need to talk to, and maybe I can do more good for this person by changing their neighborhood as a whole. Or do you continue to fight and fight and fight for 20, 30 minutes while many other people who could be talked to in a rational way are walking by and nobody's speaking to them?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what you're dealing with in that case is the person who reacts that way is retreating into insanity. That it's like a bunch of children playing a game in a schoolyard. And they're playing the game as a way of trying to run away from reality. And you come along and say something like, there's a fire in the school, and it frightens them. So they retreat into the game and play the game as if they didn't hear anything. What you have people like the fundamentalist is the fundamentalist of the type you describe is a kind of psychotic, or it's a psychotic state. There's no spirituality in it. What there is a sense that it's a kind of Freemasonry. For example, the case of run into this business about the Great Awakening of Jonathan Edwards, who's a paradigm for fundamentalism of that type in the United States. Yeah, we'll have a meeting up and down the Connecticut River Valley, and they say, "Here I am, Jonathan Edwards, and you are nothing. You are scum. You are worthless. God hates you and despises you. But because of his magnificent grace, he has appointed me here to give you an offer that if you come forward and become his today, you worthless thing, despite your worthlessness, he will bless you." Right? Now, this does not really express a principle of spirituality. What it says is, in his opinion, God is a guy with bad taste. Right? And you're getting into bad company, which is the case. Right? But what people do is they flee from their fears, their fear of life, their sense of worthlessness of life. And they flee into that by saying, "I'm part of this club. I've got a membership card. Look, I've got a membership card. Look, I got to believe in this membership card. I got to believe. You can't take my membership card away from me because I'm a nothing then if you take it away from me. So whenever you challenge my membership card, I'm going to start reciting my membership, read on my membership card, on the notations. It says here in the Bible, this is promised to me personally. God personally wrote these words, and he promised this to me personally. You're not going to take this away from me." And it's very difficult to get through. And say, well, maybe God has a different understanding of the Bible than you do. And walk away.
Amen. Okay, let's take another question from the audience. Delonte Bass?
How you doing, Mr. LaRouche? Okay, kind of ties into his question. In the process of what we're doing in D.C. and virtually all over the world, this idea that, you know, we have to create leaders amongst leaders. Now, as you're watching the process going on in D.C., we're gaining a lot of new people coming in. So therefore, you have to, you know, take a certain accountability for other people's mind and developing them to become leaders and understanding the entire mission that you're putting forward. One thing I was thinking about was this question of the Mons Brigade, right? Now, there's a certain confusion, I think, amongst this because, you know, people think maybe the Mons Brigade is a certain day that you start turning on your intellectual light one day and then turn it off on another. But the idea of a Mons Brigade principle, I would like for you to actually, you know, explain it in further detail so we can put this into the briefing.
All right, fine. Okay, well, in the 18th century, during the 18th century, which was a very bad period of degradation of European civilization, from the high point of the earlier period, that is, that you had a terrible period into 1648, 1511 to 1648, of religious warfare, of which the Spanish were the worst offenders in this operation, the Habsburgs generally. But Europe was demoralized by this. Then you had, as a result of this end of this war, which was largely done by the intervention of Cardinal Mazarin, who developed the basis for the Treaty of Westphalia, which was agreed upon, which ended formal religious warfare in Europe. You had under Colbert one of the most magnificent surges of economic and technological progress in the world, in France, during that period. Then Colbert was pushed aside by Louis XIV, who got France into a lot of new wars, together with the Habsburgs and so forth. So this was a fairly dark period, but in this period, one element of the Colbert tradition was notable in France, and this was around the building of roads and things of that sort in military affairs. And this became the Monge operation, of which Lazare Carnot was a product, a leading product. So Monge defended at a time that the so-called 18th century Enlightenment was spreading, defended the principles of constructive geometry as opposed to so-called formalistic Cartesian or empiricist geometries, and also made a number of inventions and actually organized people as he went into a later period, in the period of the French Revolution, in setting up a system of education called Mons Brigades. That is, in the École Polytechnique of that period. And this is a period in which France was transformed briefly between 1792 and 1794, at a time that Lazare Carnot was in charge of the military defense of France. It was a period in which France was about to be overrun by invading armies and chopped up into pieces. And Lazare Carnot, with a shattered France, moved in, gave it leadership, and transformed France in several respects, both in terms of principles of military conduct and so forth, but also used the École Polytechnique as a way of making a number of scientific technological revolutions in France at the time, including the deployment of a new type of mobile field artillery, which sort of changed the order of battle until Napoleon reversed it and went back to another type of artillery. So during this period, they took people in at essentially secondary school age as members of what we call brigades. And what you're doing now with the youth movement is something quite similar. I specified the following terms, that you concentrate, first of all, on the mastery of fundamental principles. And I chose the Gauss 1799 argument as the crucial point in which you're able to define the difference between a man and a beast. That you can define practically the principle of spirituality, of the difference between man and a beast, by understanding that the human mind is capable of seeing anomalies in the evidence. In certain cases, the anomalies show you that you can discover a principle which shows you something operating beyond the capabilities of sense perception. But it's actually like the principle of gravity, which you cannot eat, so you can't lick it, you can't taste it. But it exists. You demonstrate it by anomalies. You conduct experiments which prove that your discovery of the principle is valid. Now, therefore, you see the universe is being operated upon by something called gravity. Gravity you cannot see with the senses. You cannot detect it with the senses. You can detect its effects with the senses. But the principle is known to you by discovery. Now, no monkey could discover that, nor probably could head of the Democratic National Committee, the chairman. He and the monkey would probably sit there never discovering gravity. And they certainly don't appreciate the gravity of their present situation. But a human being can. So this is the quality of spirituality. So I said, well, okay, to do this, to take this principle of the complex domain, that is the relationship between what you can see and the effects you can see, or what drives the effects you can see, but you cannot see the cause directly. But this gives you a sense of what science is, what knowledge is, what truth is, and what a human being is as distinct from a beast. Now, this means you have to do this not as a matter of teaching at a student body. You have to engage a certain size of number of young people in a Platonic dialogue, a Socratic dialogue. And you need between 15 and 25 people in a class to do this, because the class must not be so large that some people don't get a chance to participate. And it must be large enough so that on any discussion, some people will get the discussion started. So that's, now this is what Monge did in effect. Monge got the idea of taking groups of people, which he called brigades. These were students in their late adolescence who would enter on what we call a high school level. And they would be transformed into scientists within 3 or 4 years. Transformed into scientists. The greatest discoveries that came out of France in this period came largely from people who had gone in as boys at a high school level, would we call it today, and had come out as scientists. So my view is, all right, let's take youth who are being abandoned by their parents or hated by their parents because they're messy or they don't understand how to be a baby boomer. And we have to find a way of making them powerful. And this method will make them powerful by making them intellectually powerful. They will develop a habit of discovery. They will get a habit of working. Now, for example, in the deployment in the Washington, D.C. area, we have an example of military training which does not exist in the U.S. military otherwise today. It was called the Auftragstaktik, or mission orientation. The way the youth movement deploys, which the old, I won't say what they are, can't do, is they have a sense of mission orientation. This is one reason I wanted to keep the old folks away from them. Because they would suppress them. They would tell them, you've got to do it in an orderly way, you've got to do it according to some rule. Like, no. Let them apply the lesson of the Monge principle, in this case the Gauss principle, apply that lesson to what they are doing, because they're engaged in social processes. And social processes are inherently just as lawful as so-called physical scientific processes. So by looking at the situation and working it in a dialogue mode, they will improvise and say, we did enough of that, now they're going to be expecting us to do that tomorrow, we're not going to do that, we're going to do something different. Huh? And so this is what is called mission orientation, mission tactics, which used to be the secret of the German military, Auftragstaktik. Now these young fellows, without being trained in Auftragstaktik, but simply by proceeding from this standpoint, have replicated a technique of Auftragstaktik, which is unknown to the German military today. As a matter of fact, it's banned. It would make them too effective. Right? So the Mose Brigade is that concept. It's just another name for that concept. It's the name of what was developed under the École Polytechnique, which is France at that period was the leading nation in science in the world during that period. It was destroyed by the effects of Napoleon, destroyed by the post-Napoleonic period. So therefore, the non-multiplicate is used for that purpose. But I devise this with foreknowledge, because this is the only way that the youth, under the conditions they're living under, as I've written about this many times, would, under these conditions, be able to cope with the way they've been dumped into history by the baby boomer generation. They had to find some self-sustaining way of knowing what truth is when the adult generation, now in their 50s, 60s, does not believe in truth. They believe in opinion. They don't believe in truth. So in a time of crisis, when all the established opinion is now becoming decadent and disreputable, young people need a sense of truth. They need a mooring point. How do we know what is true, what is false? They have to know it for themselves, not because somebody tells them it's true. They have to know of their own internal experience what is true and what is not true, or what truth means, what is not truth. And it's worked. And the way the deployment has gone in the streets of Washington, D.C., demonstrates effective organizing, which is this improvisation done by the troops themselves, where the mission is clear. We've discussed the mission. The mission is set. Now, knowing the mission, how do you carry out the mission tomorrow morning in this particular piece of terrain? Auftragstaktik, mission orientation. The highest level of achievement in military science in the German military, which they no longer have it. We got it.
You're listening to a live broadcast from Washington, D.C. by Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche. I'd like to just remind listeners that they can hear Mr. LaRouche on television tonight in Manchester, New Hampshire at 7:30 p.m. on WMUR-TV and tomorrow on WRC-TV, that's Channel 4 here in Washington, at 12:30 in the afternoon. As I think most of the people who are listening to this broadcast know, Tuesday is the first Democratic primary of the 2004 presidential campaign. It takes place in Washington, D.C. I would like to invite people who are listening to come in and to help over the course of the next few days. You can do so by calling 1-800-929-7566, and volunteers manning those phones will help you. Also, for those people who may not be able to free themselves up immediately, January 27th is the primary in New Hampshire, and we would like your help there as well. Lynn, I'm going to read you this question. It is from a young man who is an intern with the Congressional Black Caucus. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. I'm here in D.C. attending Howard University Law School on a grant provided by the Congressional Black Caucus, and I also serve as an intern on staff with CBC. I'm a little bit confused by what's going on. As you probably know, Howard Dean comes from a state with no cities and no black people. I think there are probably some. He says he's looking for the votes of people with Confederate flags on their pickup trucks. Well, so's the Ku Klux Klan. I'm also sure you know that members of the caucus have been getting up one right after the other, including Jesse Jackson Jr., to endorse Dean. Can you tell me what the hell is going on?
Normally, Jesse Jackson Jr. is much superior to his father. Maybe his mother has something to do with it. In the case, I think that Jesse Jackson Jr.'s mother has an opposite effect on her son, contrary to what Barbara Bush has on her firstborn son. That was, he went up and Bush went down. Now, this is what's going on is essentially someone like Jesse Jackson Sr., who is mature at this practice, says, look where the money is. Don't worry about the politics. Find out where the money is. And that's what's controlling it. Money. That's simple. Money directly and indirectly. You want to have a campaign? Get somebody to give you the money. Get somebody to pay you. Get somebody to put the cash in your kitty. And that's what controls these guys. Now, Jesse Jackson Jr. is essentially intrinsically a good guy. He was going to come into California and do a good job. He would have done a good job. But he was discouraged by his daddy, who is more of the Al Gore-leaning type. And therefore, he's been, in a sense, corrupted by this process. He should have been with us. But he's told if he wants to get, if he wants to make it, he has to go along to get along and look for the cash lies. So therefore, there's a stampede into this Dean thing. And we haven't even determined what country Dean's loyalties lie with. I'm not sure he knows what the state of Vermont is. He's got a very bad record, Dean has. So bad that he made carefully kept his, had his record as governor sealed so he couldn't be investigated while he was running for office. He's a disaster. And this is a disaster. People going in that direction, they're not serious. But as I said at the, my remarks today, my principal remarks today, that all this nonsense is going to come to a big crashing collapse. We don't know exactly what point in the campaign this will occur, but the whole financial system is coming down. And it's coming down in a way beyond the belief of most of the true believers who are supporting these campaigns. So what someone in the position of the questioner should do, the only advice I can give them, go with the truth. Forget which way the winds are blowing. Go with the truth. Don't let the wind set your sails. You set your sails. You choose your route. You choose your destination. Don't go with the crowd. Go with yourself. Be true to yourself.
People can continue to submit questions. We will entertain them. I should also say, though, for people who might be wondering, I am giving precedence to the young men and women who have been organizing here in Washington, D.C. for Mr. LaRouche. I think anyone who has witnessed the transformation of Washington over the course of the last couple of months as a result of their organizing knows that, in fact, this presidential candidate and this presidential campaign uniquely does belong to them. And therefore, I think that they do, they've earned the right to ask their questions and get them answered while they have the candidate here. Adam, you had a question, right?
Greetings, Lynn. I have a question specifically on a certain part of Sinarchism known as the Congress of Vienna. And I've heard people in the organization talk about Hitler a lot, Lord Shelburne, but the Congress of Vienna doesn't come up unless you bring it up. For instance, in the Mind speech, you went into it a little bit. Can you just help me fit that in a little more? Thanks.
Well, that was the Congress of Vienna, which is otherwise known as the Sexual Congress of Vienna. No, quite literally. One of the ways you had all these heads of state and others gathering in Vienna. And what they had there was Metternich organized countesses and others to provide entertainment
for potentates of various types visiting the Congress. And thus the actual affairs of the Congress were managed by Metternich and Castlereagh because everybody else was busy counting with countesses in bedrooms. And that's, so this operation was a filthy operation, and the intention was twofold. On the part of the British monarchy, and the Habsburgs, the purpose was to establish a control over the world to make sure that the American Revolution's influence would not spread into Europe. The primary purpose of the Congress of Vienna was to eradicate the influence of the American Revolution in Europe. Now, the second purpose was to destroy the Habsburgs by the British. This operation was conducted under the direction of Shelburne's principal operative, Jeremy Bentham. Jeremy Bentham was the head of the secret committee of the British Foreign Office, which ran the French Revolution and put Napoleon into motion as a Sinecist operation. So from that point on, Jeremy Bentham organized a number of things, including Palmerston's control, Mazzini's Young Europe was organized by Jeremy Bentham. Lord Palmerston, who continued to run Young Europe and orchestrated the Revolution of 1848, was a part of this operation. Palmerston was a trained successor of Bentham. That's how it operated. So Palmerston effectively destroyed the Metternich, with whom the British had allied in 1815 against the American Revolution. The Napoleon III was a creation of Palmerston. The Confederacy was a creation of Palmerston, run from London. The Confederacy in the United States was created as a part of Sinecism before it was called Sinecism, the Martinist cult. Napoleonic officers were deployed. The training of West Point was corrupt in the teaching of Jomini, which was the characteristic of the military thinking of those people in West Point who were part of the Confederacy. So in this process, what you have is a corrosive process which goes through many phases, takes different forms, but always has the same principal features. From the beginning, as the case of the British East India Company represents, it was always bankers in the Venetian tradition of Venetian financial oligarchy which have run Sinecism. And they've controlled many things. For example, what it controls, Cheney and company, is Sinecism. What controls this group around Maritornes, what controls the Spanish influence in the Americas today, the leading Spanish influence, is Sinecism. Pure and simple. Fascism of the worst type. In the tradition of the Grand Inquisitor of Torquemada. This is what is operating. So it does come in many forms. You have to understand the principle of the matter. The principle is this. You go back to the 15th century. The collapse of the power of the old Venetian power, Venetian Norman Alliance, in the new dark ages of the 14th century, created the opening in which the 15th century Renaissance occurred. From the beginning of the Renaissance, at least the latter point, forces organized around Venice with the residue of the old Norman apparatus, organized around the Habsburgs largely, created the Inquisition in Spain, and used the Spanish Inquisition as a model for what became known later as Sinecism. That is the Beastman conception of Torquemada. The expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492 is characteristic of this process. But the launching of religious war from 1511 to 1648 throughout Europe was again an attempt to destroy the Renaissance and its effects. The 18th century, the rise of empiricism, denial of the spiritual quality of man, which is what the empiricism is. The rise of the British East India Company, the attempt to form an empire of the British East India Company, and the games were played with Europe in various parts of the world, are all part of the same continuity, the same thing. So actually there is no ins or out. It's a very simple issue. There's a tradition, the same tradition that goes back to the struggles in European civilization from the beginning. The struggle against that evil was the cult of Delphi. The evil that was sophistry. The evil that was the Eleatics. The evil that was Rome. And so forth. All of these things are a continuity of a struggle between two forces in European history. One, man as made in the likeness of the Creator, as different from the apes. And therefore, all human life is sacred. All persons are sacred because they partake of the divine as no animal does. And those who try to reduce mankind to a beast who can be hunted or herded like an animal for the pleasure of another or the profit of another, that's essentially the issue. And we've reached the point that the human race, with technology, with the growth of population, can no longer survive if we tolerate these kinds of beasts, like the Spanish Inquisition, loose in society still today. Hitler is an example of that. How many more Hitlers can humanity tolerate? We can't. Therefore, we as human beings must grow up. We must finally have a society which fulfills what was the stated objective of the American Revolution and Constitution, that man can no longer be a beast to man, that we must build a community of nations, not a world government, not a globalization, but a community among nations, where the nations agree on a common purpose among nations for each other's benefit and for the security of them all. We must build a bulwark of this against a continuation of this horror show which European civilization in particular has been subjugated all these thousands of years. Now has come the time, the challenge. Do we have the ability now, on the verge of the greatest horror show that mankind has known so far, do we now at long last have the resolution and ability to recognize that we must now create a community of sovereign nation states as a bulwark against any further repetition of this nonsense?
Okay, Nick, you want to make an announcement, right? Nick is going to make an announcement, and then the next question is going to come from Ed Hamler. I can also tell you that one of the first things we're going to do when Mr. LaRouche gets elected president is we're going to make sure that the first primaries take place in the South where it's warm. Make your announcement.
Just a quick announcement for a meeting directly following this webcast. And that's that if all non-members who specifically are from Washington, D.C., could meet in the lobby area, or meet, let's say, directly outside of here, and then we'll walk together to a lobby area so we can sit down and actually hash out a strategy for the next 3 days in terms of what we're going to have to do to get people who have now been mobilized over the past couple weeks by the youth movement to make sure that they'll be able to get out and vote on the 13th. So thank you very much if you'd definitely meet with us afterwards after this. Thank you.
Hello, Lynn. The other day we had a class in D.C. Well, I made a certain breakthrough, which was pretty fun, after a Poe reading. And following right after was a crisis, a healthy crisis. And this is involved with this question of leadership. Now, what I figured out was that I guess where leadership comes from is pretty much what you discussed a little earlier, where it's an acceptance of your own immortality, and thereby you understand what the mission actually is. Okay, now the crisis was, okay, how do you generate that constantly? How can you be a leader all the time rather than in specific instances where you're reacting to something in a certain way, but actually understanding the quality as a whole and functioning based off of that principle?
Well, first of all, do you love people? That's the first requirement of leadership. You have to love people. You have to care about them. You have to love them more than you love yourself. You have to think of doing things that are for them. You have to think about actions which are gifts to others. This goes with a sense of immortality, like the scientists. You know, most of the great discoveries in physical science have come after years of work and struggle by the discoverers. It's a real battle of a certain special kind. And usually you get these leading scientists who make contributions, and they get pretty creaky about the time they really have consolidated their position as a discoverer or something or other. And then they go off and die on you. It's a real disappointment. Like Robert Moon, our dear friend, who's a very prolific discoverer in his own way. So it's a sense of loving to serve people by making contributions, especially contributions which are of a more durable type, such as discovery of a principle or turning people who seem frustrated and insecure and turn them into more self-confident people who are self-starters, who have find a mission in life, who find satisfaction in life. It's what you give to others and in this way which makes you a leader. The qualification, the technical qualification of leadership is insight, it's the development of the powers of mind, it's knowledge, but that's not enough. You have this knowledge, this ability has to be developed constantly, and it has to be expressed essentially by love for mankind. If you don't have love for mankind, you can't be a leader, not a real one.
Do we have another question from the audience? Karen?
Not that tall. Hi. I have a question about truth. Because you talk with young people at the campuses, and this occurred yesterday, where you get young people who say things like, well, there's societal truths. There are truths that everybody agrees upon, like x squared equals 4. It's a truth. It's, the answer is 2, right? And so you agree upon it. And the question is asked, well, how would you construct it? And they say, x squared equals 4. That's how you do it. Right? Why? Well, because the society agreed upon that. And the thing is, how do you... when you have somebody who's doing that, how do you actually get them to really break through on it? Because we went through the geometry and things, but he wasn't quite getting it. You know what I mean? He wasn't quite getting the idea that truth is universal and everybody can know it. So.
All right. Well, just take a very simple question. Take the question of doubling the cube. They do it. Do it. Double the cube. By geometric construction, double the cube. Therefore, can you double the cube? If you can't double the cube, then what is truth? Truth is something which is unique and must be demonstrated, demonstrable to the individual mind. It's not other-directed. See, this is what the point was. What is the significance of empiricism or reductionism? Human beings are dangerous. They're dangerous to whom? They're dangerous to those who want to herd human beings as cattle. What makes them dangerous? That they have the ability to discover universal physical principles, which a monkey can't. So what do? You say, okay, you are all now decreed to be monkeys. We'll prove it to you by putting in your classroom where your degrees depend upon behaving like a monkey. That you will monkey see, monkey do. And the way to say, well, you mean societal values, you mean monkey see, monkey do. And don't do too much around me.
Okay, the next question comes from somebody who is actually at the audience gathered in Detroit. What he asks is the following. He says, Mr. LaRouche, speaking as you are from Washington, D.C., and realizing that probably the greatest speech delivered by Dr. Martin Luther King came while he was in D.C., would you please comment on what you see as the greatest strength of the movement that Dr. King led? And also, please identify what are the common threads between what Dr. King was trying to accomplish and what you are trying to accomplish. Thank you.
Well, it's pretty much the same in one essential sense. In my view, that Martin's greatest achievement is expressed by his mountaintop address, the most important thing he did, because there he identified a principle, the principle of immortality, as his characteristic. This becomes obvious when we look at the people around King and what they did, the close to him, and leadership, and what they failed to do after Martin died. They had not gone to the mountaintop. They had not understood what that meant. They could not, they were concerned about gimmicks. They were concerned about gadgets for building the movement, tricks for building the movement. And the obvious thing, as even Jim Babel should have understood from the children's activity, which Jim conceived of and Martin proposed, how did children who were mobilized at that point, how did children do what they did? They also went to the mountaintop. And some of the best leaders of the civil rights movement after Martin had died came from those children who'd gone through the experience of the children operations under Martin. The most important thing about civil rights is you've got to impart to the victim of the denial of civil rights a sense of their humanity. And Jim Crow, as much as slavery and forms of Jim Crow today, essentially work on a denial of humanity, where a fellow says, I feel human, but he walks with a shuffle, sensing that his humanity is not something that is acknowledged. And you have to give him strength. Strength under the conditions he or she lives in which they have that sense of humanity is imparted to them. That sense of humanity is imparted by projecting it to them, yourself. You see, the problem of many people who want to be leaders who fail is they're not leaders because they're selfish. They're concerned about their immediate physical self and immediate satisfaction. Every phony, every faker in politics will always tell you what he's going to do for you. And what he's going to do for you is not just do something you have a right to, but he's going to try to convince you that your relationship to him is the physical benefit, the object he wants, you're going to get in that object. And you say, well, what are you going to do with that object once you die, brother? What are you going to do with what I give you when you die? Am I going to give you something which will give you a sense of your humanity, a sense of your immortality? And Martin was doing that. And that was his achievement. Most people are saying, we'll give you a job, we'll give you better pay, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. We'll buy you. We'll buy you with our promises. Martin didn't do that. Martin aimed at the soul. And that's where he was different. And the highest point, I think, was reached shortly before he was killed. And maybe that was why he was killed. Because he, unlike the people around him, immediately in leadership, was a true leader. They weren't a danger to the enemy. They weren't a danger to J. Edgar Hoover.
For those of you who are listening over the internet, you're listening to a live broadcast of an address in Washington on the eve of the Washington, D.C. Democratic primary, which is being delivered by Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche. I think that anybody listening to this broadcast, or anybody who has heard Mr. LaRouche speak before, knows in fact that this is no ordinary presidential campaign, but it is also not an ordinary time in U.S. history. The fact of the matter is that we're going for a breakthrough in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, but we have a long campaign ahead of us. Mr. LaRouche has the second largest base of reported contributors among any of the Democratic candidates. But we still need help. We need resources, we need money, and we need manpower. And therefore, I really do want to urge both people gathered here today and people who are listening over the internet to actually contribute to this historic campaign in whatever way you can. The next question comes from the audience here. It's from Mike Reeves.
Hello. Yes. I have two questions, Lynn. The first is one I had intended to email to you, but something went wrong. It's about Henry Wallace. And I just want to know if there's a failure on his part to maintain the hold of Roosevelt's policies on the U.S. government, because there are certain things about his thinking, such as an endorsement of Woodrow Wilson, I find in his writings, which I can't explain. I just don't see him as being someone who could have been fooled by Wilson, and I'm wondering why that endorsement, and was he trying to oversimplify things for the American people, and was that perhaps a flaw that led to the enemy being able to remove him from the position of vice president? The other question I have is this thing we run into in the streets all the time, is the sense in the population of Washington, D.C., that the crisis that we're facing is bigger than them. That's almost verbatim, right? This thing is bigger than me. You're going against Cheney. You better watch out. You're going to get killed. They locked up LaRouche for 5 years. They'll lock me up and throw away the key. And people see this as a real threat. And in fact, for a lot of people, it is real. So how do you, first question on Wallace, and then how do you deal with that second issue?
Well, take the first one is simpler, so I'll take it. The second one is simpler, so I'll take it first. What you're talking about is people have a sense of hostage circumstances. Now, I saw that with you referred to the imprisonment process. The big problem I had, people around me didn't have my sense of certainty about things. And therefore, other considerations came into the defense, other than my view. My view was, which was not the view shared by all the defense, was the truth. We fight to get the truth out. You don't say, well, this tactic will win, that tactic will lose. The lawyers were pressing everybody to go with phony tactics, because we had a bunch of lawyers thrown at us, really. We didn't have any time to prepare a case, as we did in Boston. So the lawyers were putting pressure on the defendants. Be smart. be smart. Think about your personal future. Cut a deal. Or beg. Don't anger the judge. I said, to hell with the judge. If my life is going down now, I'm not going to spoil it now. And that's where the problem arises. Now, as in leading, that's what you have to worry about. You have to worry about the people who are working with you, because they will often be flaked off. Once they're put to the test, and this was always the problem with the baby boomers, when the baby boomers were taken to the test, they would tend to flake off because of the whole syndrome of that generational syndrome, which I understood very well. I'm an older guy, tougher. I don't flake off. But in leadership, you have to have people who don't flake off. Then you have to deal with that problem among people, but you have to understand it. And only when you get the sense of immortality. Well, okay, you might die. Right? Let's agree, you might be killed. Cheney might kill you. Now you're going to die anyway, aren't you? What kind of a man is going to die? Maybe you won't die. Maybe we'll win. People die in war. You don't go to war because you might die. You surrender to the enemy because you won't die, even if you might die. You don't do that. Now, Woodrow Wilson is an interesting problem, because Wilson was a racist bastard. He was a pig of the worst type, like Teddy Roosevelt. He probably in some ways was more of a slime ball than Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was a thug. He was an obvious thug with no intellectual pretensions of much at all. Wilson was a college university professor, a stereotype of the worst from today. And he was a racist. His family were real hardcore supporters of the Klan. And he, from the White House, set it going. But what happened? The Democratic Party had been given Woodrow Wilson largely by Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt had made Woodrow Wilson president. Why not? The two second generation of the Confederacy. Two good old Confederate old boys getting together there, one helping out the other. All for the sake of the Klan and for the lost cause. But then, see, they had this idea that the defeat of Germany, the United States saving of civilization by defeating Germany, which wasn't really much of an accomplishment, and then the idea we were going to have peace, that Versailles was going to be peace, that Wilson's ideas were going to mean peace, justice for oppressed nations, and peace. And this became almost a religious chant within the Democratic Party. Even Roosevelt partook of this to a certain degree, though he was smarter than that. Wallace was a decent fellow, but he wasn't Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt made something of Wallace. Wallace was a very brilliant fellow, came from a generation of in agriculture. He was a perfect agricultural minister, and he was also dedicated to Roosevelt. And therefore, the most he would have done would have kept the Roosevelt flag on high as president, had he been the replacement. And that's the reason they got rid of him. They got rid of him because the right wing had taken over. Who were the right wing? The people who tried to kill Roosevelt. The people behind Raskob earlier. The Morgans, the Mellons, the DuPonts, the Harrimans. These were the people, the fascists. Remember, it was Averill Harriman's firm, which employed Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the president incumbent, as his chief officer, who moved the money in German banks to put Hitler back into power. And the DuPonts and the Mellons and the Morgans were all behind it. The DuPonts and the Mellons and the Morgans were behind the plot, a military plot, to kill the president and overthrow the government in 1934. And this is what Truman represented. He was their choice against Wallace.
And what we had with Truman was something we call McCarthyism. And Truman was not only McCarthyism, but Truman was the advocate of preventive nuclear warfare, the Dick Cheney of his time. And the section of the Democratic Party that became the neoconservatives were the followers like Jackson from Oregon, or Washington. They were this was the neocons were Democrats. What kind of Democrats? They were Truman Democrats. Preventive nuclear warfare Democrats. They were racists and killers. And we got, look, in 1947 I understood this. I wrote to Eisenhower when he was president of Columbia University in 47 and laid out the case of why he had to run for president to get rid of this guy Truman. And he just wrote back and said he agreed. I gave him quite an argument about what the promises were of the war, and it was a short letter. No, he got the point. He said he agreed, but it's not his time. In the next term election, he ran. And he ran to free the United States from Truman. Truman was induced to resign over the issues of the Korea War, which Truman had gotten us into. And because the preventive nuclear warfare doctrine had fallen because the Soviet Union had developed a thermonuclear device. So he had to give up Truman's doctrine. Eisenhower was always opposed to what he called later the military-industrial complex. That was Truman. That is Cheney. That is the neoconservatives. So that's where Wallace's significance lies, in the fact that he was pushed out. He would not have gone for that. He would have probably babbled about Woodrow Wilson, because there was a certain kind of liberal sentimentality running loose in among even the better Democrats of that sort. So the fine distinctions I make were not always with all the others. They were with Roosevelt. Roosevelt understood this stuff, but he didn't. But the point was, Truman is the problem.
Lynn, we've gotten about half a dozen questions along the lines of, all along the same lines. So I'm going to kind of mix two of them together and give you a chance to answer it. It says, Lynn, what do you think of this theory that's presented to my generation at the behest of the baby boomers, that being irrational or being unable to control mood swings is some chemical function of the brain? It just can't be the case that my generation suffers from some kind of unique chemical imbalance. Yet, at least half of the people that we meet are on some kind of drug. Now, it may be the case that this was also true with baby boomers, but they chose to do drugs. In my generation, we're given drugs, and we're given them very early on. We're given antidepressants, anti-anxiety pills, and other kinds of medication, and are told that this is helpful and necessary. Can you please say something about this?
Well, this is simply brainwashing. Read Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. Soma, this is Soma. What's the purpose? Is to make you stupid. It's done deliberately. And if, in fact, it was also done to the baby boomer generation. Soma was administered. It was called LSD. LSD was a synthetic drug based on a naturally produced substance, which is called psychotomimetic drugs, and made out of this rust. So this was done to try to find a way of mass drugging people to make them totally irrational and non-creative. The function here has always been, like empiricism, for example. Empiricism was designed to make people stupid, make them inhuman. Empiricism says, as like your x squared equals 4, that's empiricism. That means the person who does that is stupefied. Yeah, well, that's that. That's that. Which we agreed, it's that. It's a social contract. That's stupidity. I'm a cow, he's a cow, she's a cow, moo. It's the nature of the beast, shall we say. Now, this problem, what we have is the following problem. If you're in a society which is organized by a bunch of drug addicts, and remember, in drug addicts, you know, middle class, what do middle class housewives take? Thorazine, or similar kinds of drugs, poppers of one kind or another. It was a society like that. And so what happens is they create a society in which they brought this about. They brought about this drugging program, which hits the younger generation. They created it. And it's all, you have parents destroying their children. The significant part about this is with the younger generation now, the children who've been looking at what they're in, they say, we have been dumped into a no future society. We are not going to go along. Our parents are, in that sense, our enemies. You can't talk to our parents. They won't listen. They're stupid. They don't know what they're talking about. They're off in a hysterical cult. You tell them there's reality and they scream. They say, that's interfering with my lifestyle. They're lifestyle freaks. And they believe in this stuff. As a result of this kind of, as a result of the people in their 50s, now entering their 60s, the younger generation has been stuck into a swamp of drug culture. Now, what do you think you've got on television? What do you think? Do you think anybody with a brain can watch the movies that are being produced now? They're boring. They're absolutely boring. There's no structure to them whatsoever. It's like one of these crazy rock video things. They're all like rock video. You're in a society that has no meaning. You're in a nightmare, an existentialist nightmare. And you find around you that the effect of the second generation of druggies, the first generation was your parents' generation, and don't let them kid you. Some of us were there. We saw it. Bunch of druggies. Now you're the second generation who've been victimized by the effects of the first degeneration. I do say degeneration advisedly. How do we do it? How do we deal with it? We have to deal with it. We have to decide, as a layer of the population, we are not going to let this become a third generation, which is all the way down to the bottom. We are going to have to find ways to heal those who are victimized by this drug culture. But as I said in New Hampshire, the baby boomer generation has no idea what they're talking about when they talk about the drug culture. None. You who are younger have some sense of it. It's different. You're seeing the debris as a result of the previous generation's drug culture. When they shove Ritalin into you in schools, when they shove Prozac into you, which is a deadly thing, turn people into actual physical vegetables with this crap. And they do it. They say, no, we don't accept that. And the human will, particularly when reinforced by a bunch of people getting together and agreeing, is a wonderfully powerful force. And you have to use that force and get us free of that. But the generation that is victimized, which is adult but has been victimized, is the best way of getting rid of the disease their parents' generation dumped on them.
Okay, Lynn, this is a question from Will Van, who's here. He says, Lynn, do you think it would be possible to create rap or hip-hop music which embodies the classical method through the use of poetry and metaphor?
No, couldn't be done, because it defies the very principle of classical composition. Classical composition is a principle of development. It's based in counterpoint. Repetition, simple repetition. For example, what I referred to as Megan's Revenge at a recent conference, the case of Rameau. Rameau is actually the predecessor of hip-hop. No, you take a principle of composition, it has no beginning and no end. What do they do in order to end this kind of stuff? What do you do, fade out? Where's the end? You have, in Germany, you have this thing which is this special sausage, which has a core which is mustard. And this is made in a sort of indefinite lengths. And you can chop it off at any point. And you've got your piece of right? So this is like the infinite kind of sausage of that type. And that's what this so-called music is. You know, okay, 3 minutes, and you're off stage. So 2 minutes and 55 seconds, fade. There's no way that you can turn that into music.
The next question is from a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement from Utah. Chris Stasser, are you here?
Hi there, Lynn. Chris here. We've had a lot of fun this week meeting with our chairman of the Utah Democratic Party, Mr. Donald Dunn. We talked to Dunn, and one of the ideas we wanted to get across was the sacredness of the institution of the presidency. And why is it that the Democratic Party is shutting you out of this process? And Dunn's response was, well, Mr. LaRouche can run as an independent. That's fine. But this is a private party. What's your response to that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's put it in a cage and lock the doors. It's called a private party. And you can go there on weekends and get drunk all you want to. But you're not going to do that to run this nation. You're not going to do anything which is exclusionary, which injures the right of any other part of the population. This is a totally voluntary procedure. Besides, on top of this, the more important thing is, look, the accusations against LaRouche are a lie. They're known to be a lie to the Democratic Party leadership. Anybody who condones a crime like that, of lying to defraud the people of access to a candidate, is criminal. If you support them, you're committing a crime. That you are giving to McAuliffe, who's a person of doubtful morals himself, an authority over you, which you shouldn't accept. By accepting that, you degrade yourself and betray your nation and betray the Constitution. This thing was put into effect through the influence of a section of the Justice Department, which is the most corrupt and evil right-wing bunch of bastards the Justice Department has. And it was the son of that bastard who did this with the Democratic Party. It's a violation of the Constitution in support of a doctrine espoused by a fascist member of the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia. That's the fact of the matter. Therefore, this is a crime. It's a crime against the Constitution. We don't care what the judge says, it's a crime against the Constitution. And if you support it, you are an accomplice to that crime. You've got to decide whether you're a man or a mouse.
Seems to be a two-part question. It's from the West Coast. It says, Mr. LaRouche, you criticized the other nine candidates for having no plan for dealing with the crises that you've outlined, but you didn't really go through your own solution. In particular, could you please elaborate how your proposal to actually place the U.S. government through bankruptcy proceedings would actually work? Would you default on all of the national debt, on just part of it? How would you induce other governments to join with you in putting their governments into bankruptcy? And how would you maintain a banking system? Also related to this is the current breakdown of agriculture in the United States. I think that this is depicted by this current mad cow business. Or do you think that that whole thing is just a hoax?
Well, see, the system is already bankrupt. Nobody's putting anything into bankruptcy. It's already bankrupt. The international financial system, monetary system is bankrupt. The U.S. is bankrupt. At least 48 states are bankrupt, hopelessly bankrupt. Who's putting anybody into bankruptcy? You know, putting someone into bankruptcy is not causing something which is healthy to get sick. Putting someone into bankruptcy, if it's proper, is preventing a catastrophe which is already in progress. It means that you've got a situation of this type. So therefore, if we don't act to put it in bankruptcy under the government, then there's no future for the human race. That's a pretty strong authority, isn't it? Mankind dies unless you put it into bankruptcy. Are you going to do it? Are you going to quibble? That's the choice. The question is, has the government got the guts to take a system which has been driven into bankruptcy by government, by government policy, and by bankers, who government has franchised to act as thieves and raiders and rapers, and say, you guys are all bankrupt? Now, government is responsible for bankruptcy. So government puts the system that is bankrupt into bankruptcy reorganization. What does government do with bankruptcy? It makes things work that are supposed to work. Because if you let it go through into more bankrupt, then things will close down. The firm will close down. Pensions won't be paid. People will die, because the checks don't arrive. That is what you must prevent. The function of government is to make sure that that doesn't happen. Therefore, you put things that are bankrupt into receivership and use the power of government to make sure these catastrophes don't happen. And you tell anybody who comes in for with claims and say, no, you cannot pay that person. You cannot pay that pension. You cannot meet that health care bill. You can't do it, government. You've got to give us our money first. And government says, wait a minute, we're government. You shut up, or you know where you're going to go. This is our responsibility. We're going to do it. Now, bankers will try to overthrow that government that does that. They will try to set up a fascist dictatorship, as they've done before, to deal with that kind of challenge. Have we got the guts to face those fascists? Are we going to hit them before they hit us? Now, this is the moral responsibility of the state. Anyone who is not prepared to put the system into bankruptcy has no business in government at this time. The very unwillingness to put the system into bankruptcy is a crime against humanity. And that person is a menace to society if he's anywhere near power. The only government that can be tolerated is one that is willing to put the system into bankruptcy. And you're going to see very soon, in the weeks and months ahead, that that's going to be the question. It could be the question tomorrow morning, next week, or 2 weeks from now. Somewhere in the short term, this is going to happen. And the survival of humanity will depend upon having someone who's prepared to step in and do exactly what I'm supposed to do. Now, I've explained it. I've explained this thing fully. Of exactly what I would do.
And that's exactly what I would do. Governments abroad, look, I got the majority of the parliamentarians of Italy have supported my proposal for New Bretton Woods, which is exactly this. I've got support for this idea from around the world. The idea of the strategic triangle is now a go in Europe, in Eurasia. We have it. It's ours. It's not my property, but it's something we brought into being with my influence and our influence over years. We're ready to go. I'm ready to act. None of the others are. So you just hope that I'm president or becoming president when this happens. Otherwise, humanity is in trouble.
Okay, we do have time for a couple of more questions. The next question will be from Dan Sturman from Belarus Youth Movement.
Hi, Dr. Lynn. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. I have a question about healthcare. I know you speak a lot about the HMO policies, but I've been in the EMS field for a little bit now, and I've noticed a lot of indifferences between the states. They choose to have different structures between the states, and I was wondering, what do you know about the EMS system, not the ER particularly, but the basic life support, ALS, and firefighters, and what could you do to improve them, seeing as they're a mess right now?
Well, we have to have a basic infrastructure reconstruction, which includes that. We're talking about security. Government is, in principle, responsible for anything which lies between the cracks, and which is the total territory. That private interests can only deal with fairly small or restricted parts of an economy, of society. What about the rest of it? What about public transportation? What about power and generation distribution? What about health care, so forth and so on? Public safety in general. And health care comes partly as a subcategory of public safety. Firefighting, public safety, so forth. All the emergency services thing are public safety. We've always had in the United States the ability from the beginning, because that's the way it started, the beginning to incorporate private voluntary efforts as a part of the same thing as the government effort. So the government would recognize a certain private initiative as being legitimate and saying, okay, we like it. We will cooperate with it. We will facilitate its functioning. That system should continue. But government must be responsible. If that doesn't exist, government must go out and try to find out a way of organizing it or create it itself. That's the rule of the thing. On health care, again, public security, public safety. That's the basic mission. Care for the individual, but also public safety. And it's under the category of public safety that the government's role in health care properly comes in. Not on the standpoint of the physician, apart from standards for physician certification and so forth. But it really comes in under public safety, the hospital system. If we don't have private hospitals, we have to have a public hospital. If we've got a public hospital, that's good. DC General was an excellent example of that before they shut it down. No, we have to have this idea of a mobilization of the nation for its good. The mobilization is a mission orientation by the people of a nation and its institutions of government. The government must undertake certain things by their very nature as its responsibility. But otherwise, government tries to facilitate things which are in the general interest, whether they're private or public or not. So the two things have to go together. And what you have to end up with is, at the end of the day, do we have a system composed of public and private components which are adequate to ensure that tomorrow morning we're covered? It's a simple formula. I think the formula almost is self-explanatory as to what its implications are.
Let me also just mention something about that question, because it's an area that I know a little bit about. What you have to understand, Dan, is not so much immediate issues of delivery of care, with our emergency medical services. But what it's very important to understand is that in 1973, from 1973 to 1974, along with HMO legislation, there was a bunch of enabling legislation that went along with it, which changed the way healthcare was organized in the United States. And one of the areas which was most heavily affected was the delivery of emergency medical care. Our entire system during that period was remodeled along the principles of military triage. Now, military triage plays a very important role on the battlefield, where your objective is to save life, if you can, under battlefield conditions, where you know your resources are extremely limited and where your mobility is limited. There is no justification for actually applying those principles to America's cities. But in fact, that is what occurred in 1973 and 1974. So that what you have today is that even though, and you know, many people who are involved in a EMS capacity make heroic efforts to try to change, to try to save lives, the problem is that the underlying intent and principle around which the service is actually organized is very badly flawed. And that is one of the difficulties that we have to deal with.
I understand that fully, but I just got employed by a private ambulance company, and it's weird because we do runs to New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And the laws, the laws are so different between what an EMT is in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. It's absurd that we have to do things a certain way in Pennsylvania, and we run into New Jersey, and if we don't do it their way, then we're screwed, and then
understand.
We come back, and it's just absurd that these systems.
But it's also, it's a product, obviously, of an underlying difficulty. Neil Martin had a question. To ask his question. Mr. Skywater. No. Come on. No, ask your question. Don't listen to her.
Hello, excuse me. Hello, Mr. LaRouche. My name is Atreyu, and I just started with the LaRouche Youth Movement about 3 weeks ago, a little bit longer. And I know by what I've heard from other LYM members and by what I've read by yourself that you have a no-tolerance rule about drugs. And I was wondering, do you take the same stance as our current government regarding cigarettes? What I mean by that is this. Even though prolonged usage of cigarettes causes diseases that prematurely shorten the human lifespan, and the medical community considers that a fact, our current government completely ignores this issue. Don't you agree that cigarettes are just as dangerous as conventional illegal drugs?
Not necessarily just as, in the long run they can be, but in the short term they are not. Also, there is a problem of habituation, which is not actually an addiction involved. There's also habituation in dangerous drugs as well as a factor. But no, that's not quite the same. But in general, you know, my view is that excessive regulation is bad because it becomes too oppressive. That we should, in a sense, have a certain economy in things which are might be considered oppressive, into those things which are actually a more or less immediate danger, and also, in particular, the protection of the young. That in the area of people who are minors, we should have a stronger emphasis on protection than we do on adults. And my view is to minimize the amount of regulation and control that is exerted under formal law and formal regulation. That I'd rather have an appeal to reason where that might work in creating a consensus than enforcement. Just give an example. That people do things that are destructive. They do it to themselves, they do it to others, but notably to themselves.
How do you get someone to stop doing that? You can say there's a penalty which we will impose upon you if you do it. Well, that's really not very effective. If the person themselves, himself or themselves, realizes that it's destructive, and they not only realize that, but are determined to give it up or keep it away from themselves, that's more effective. It's more, much more effective enforcement if it comes from inside than by repressive outside. My general feeling about all of this is to minimize the oppressive role of control to that which is absolutely indispensable or not avoidable. And otherwise, if something is destructive, like studying reductionist mathematics, for example, or physics, right, that let's hope that we can get people to understand that if you want to be human, you keep away from reductionist mathematics and that sort of thing. So I would rather that the power of persuasion be used to induce people to come to their own view on the matter and control their own behavior rather than having law enforcement or some other agency reaching in to enforce their behavior. That's my view on the matter. I'm reluctant to get into any more enforcement in this area than is absolutely required.
I'm starting to get militant. I'm getting militant questions from the internet from people who are distressed that they haven't been called yet. Let me just say, for people who have submitted questions, we have far more questions here than Mr. LaRouche can possibly answer. I'm trying to select questions that are representative of the questions that are being asked, and I'll give him the questions that I don't get to. We'll take another question from the audience, from Gwen Wilkerson.
Hello, Mr. Roush, how you doing? my question is, our legislators have enacted this law. It's a horrendous law called the mandatory minimum law. And I was wondering, why would they do such a thing that affects young people in such a terrible way? And
describe this to me. What is
the mandatory minimum law that has, it's a drug law where if you're caught with drugs, you can do life in prison. And people that kill and rape don't go to jail for long periods of time like that. So
I understand exactly. I know I understand exactly. And now, the problem is this. This is wrong, right? Wrong. Pushing drugs is one thing. Using drugs or small, another. I've seen this. What happens is this, and this is particularly true, is highly discriminatory on top of everything else. If you happen to be qualified as Puerto Rican or Mexican in extraction, or if you looked at as an American Negro or something, then you're likely to get much more time and more often than anyone else. Now, what the result of this is, we have, in fact, through these kinds of policies, our headhunting policies by the Justice Department and state agencies, as a result of this, we've taken a large section of young males, particularly from these strata, the Hispanic American, African American strata, so called, we have destroyed their families by this kind of thing. A guy's in for 10, 15, 20 years or longer. Based on some prosecutor wants to make a score, 5 years of the crack, he can pile it on to 6 years. He can pile it on to all, if the judge will put up with it. He piles it on. What happens then to the child of that person? What happens to the family of that person? what happens to that person when they get out of prison? What happens to them? They're destroyed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, this idea of mandatory sentencing guidelines must be abandoned. We must go back and put justice back in the hands of the judges. We must restore a system of justice which judges the case on the basis of the facts and the merits of the individual case and looks for a cure of the problem, not punishment per se. Since the middle of the 1970s, the United States went from a point policy of rehabilitation against rehabilitation to punishment as such. So therefore, it's a mistake. Punishment is a mistake. The interests of society and rehabilitation are the objectives of criminal justice. You put somebody in for a long period of time only because it is necessary to protect society from that person.
Right.
If they are a person who is an offender, you wish to rehabilitate them, you wish them to get out of the thing, you wish them to have their civil rights fully restored as soon as possible. We want them to, and particularly when you think of the thing of the young male. The young male or the young mother who goes into prison on these kinds of things, where some prosecutor says, I can get a big score because I know how it works. The Justice Department works on money and number of years. How many years does it get in sentences? How many dollars does it get in fines and so forth from a case? And the prosecutor is judged and the investigator is judged on the basis of those scores. So therefore, the more they can pile on in their district per capita, the more they get for their district, the more they get in terms of promotion. Mm-hmm. So we created a piecework incentive system for grinding up people. This is wrong.
Yeah, and our young people are the weakest people in society. And to watch the Justice Department and our legislators put these young people under this horrendous law is a travesty. It's awful. It's terrible. When there's no pharmaceutical difference with
I understand.
The yeah, so
I understand. I know this.
Yeah.
I know this.
But it's affecting our young people across the board, men and women, young women and men.
I know this is wrong.
Yeah.
This is wrong. It has to be changed.
Yeah. So how would you go about eradicating this law?
Making president. You see, you watch what happens.
Say something.
You do it.
She says she wants to free Renan Wilkerson, her father.
Okay. We'll see what we can do. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Lynn, this is the last question that I'll ask you. This comes from someone in the audience here. And I'm going to ask you this question because it gives you some leeway as the last question. It's also written really small, so this is Mr. LaRouche. I've been involved with the youth movement for a short time. An observation that I've noticed about my generation, which I admit I'm sometimes guilty of myself, is that we are sometimes cognitively lazy. There also seems to be a sense of defeat that is so strong that young people will refuse to take any responsibility at all. For example, I've spoken to some who will state right out that Cheney is one of the greatest evils of our time. And yet, even with this obvious awareness, the person still refused to get up and do anything about it. My question is that I really do believe that some people my age have seen a spark or some kind of light coming from somewhere inside a dark cave. But how can I extend a hand and help pull as many of them out as I can?
Well, this is a social process, which we, in the youth movement, have been not exactly experimenting with, but yes, we have been experimenting with it. It works. It's not a magic formula. It's a method of approaching a problem. It does not provide instantaneous cures. It provides an outlet for growth. And growing is actually involves a social process of self-development through interaction with others. And this 15 to 25 thing works very well. Mission orientation works very well. You get leaders emerge from the process, people who play leading roles, sometimes in different times, in different circumstances, in different ways. It works. It's worked beautifully. You've got to take one thing into account. If you look at the West Coast, you look at California, the operation there, you look at Philadelphia, you look at Washington, D.C., these three examples show that youth organized in this way are the most powerful political force per capita in the United States today, with all the weaknesses and all the question marks which may be posed. It's the most powerful force in politics which exists in the United States today is youth movement of this type. We just need a lot more of it. And we're doing a pretty good job. But is it enough? Well, it's never enough.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mr. LaRouche for sharing this afternoon with us.
Thank you all. Thank you all very much. You have fun? Have fun. Lots of fun.